I don't like and I don't respect the crocodile tears. To the crocodile tears. No. Allow me to finish. Sir, I don't like to play before an audience the Holocaust card. But since now I feel compelled to, my late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother, please shut up. My late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on my father's side,
the Jews did not take arms against the
my
Germans.
My late father was in Auschwitz concentration camp. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on both sides was exterminated. Both of my parents were in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it's precisely and exactly because of the lessons my parents taught me and my two siblings that I will not be silent when Israel commits its crimes against the Palestinians. And I consider nothing more despicable than to use their suffering and their martyrdom to try to justify the torture, the brutalization, the demolition of homes that Israel daily commits against the Palestinians. So I refuse any longer to be intimidated or browbeaten by the tears. If you had any heart in you, you would be crying for the Palestinians, not for the Syrians.
This is Bristol. It's Good Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 2nd of April, 2021. It's Good Friday. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Joining us too is Trade Union Socialist Coalition candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Tom Baldwin. And in the second part, Eric Prince from Blackwater. Remember him? Not the Blackwater in Surrey, though, next to the Royal Military College in Sandhurst. No, the private military company contracted by the Pentagon, NATO, and the other intelligence services, wherever there's peace, they see terror, particularly Islamist terror, like a drone. However evil the task, if proper soldiers won't do it, he will. Martin takes a look at this Machiavellian war criminal, who's one of the wealthiest people in the private armies game. And a year after the so-called emergency COVID legislation was passed and renewed, more from arguably the best-placed critic of what these policies, deplatformed by YouTube, Twitter and the rest, former Pfizer Vice President Dr. Mike Yeadon. We had an exclusive with him last week, but there's another clip this week. If you're under 60 and healthy or have had COVID, don't have a jab, he says. This week is take on who should and who shouldn't have a vaccine. And as Natalie Minnis was saying last week, the apocalypse means secrets being uncovered. Well, here's one, how to start a war. An examination of how the First World War started and why it didn't finish in 1916 when it actually conked out. And it started up for another round of human slaughter all over again. The book is Hidden History, The Hidden History of the First World War by Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor. We have a clip from Jerry. And Understanding 9/11, The Key to Stopping World War III, Webster Tarpley's 2005 lecture in New York City is one of the most outstanding explanations of what really happened that day, at least in my opinion, just over 3 years after the attacks on New York and Washington. That was removed, though, by toxic Google for so-called hate speech, but immediately it popped back up on various of the post-YouTube video platforms, thank God. Tonight, the patsies, the moles and the technicians, who are they? And how do they combine to pull off one of the most audacious false flag terror attacks in history? And also, most importantly, how might this trick be used to kick off a third world war? It's unthinkable, is it? Well, I'm afraid some people down in their bunkers can make a lot of money and grab a lot of resources in a war. Maybe, Mr. Gates, even take over the world food supply, eh? And finally, tonight will be the depopulation agenda, how to dispose of all us useless eaters, deprived of a livelihood while the Amazons, the Teslas and the Facebooks share value goes through the roof, as explained by the Cutting Through the Matrix presenter Alan Watt, who died suddenly last month, aged 55. But first, we're going to be hearing from the Conservative Police and Crime Commissioner candidate Mark Shelford, who's promising to take on Castle Park's brazen Lloyds Bank fraudsters hunkered up in the old South West Bank of England headquarters there. He's a former army officer who served in opium-ridden Afghanistan and Army Loyalist Terrorist Collusion HQ Northern Ireland. So I ask him about those too. And police raid a farm between Bath and Frome where the ex-soldiers with PTSD come for rest and recuperation. Why a police raid? Well, the police say they were suspected there were unlicensed weapons around and barred access to the former army weapons instructor who runs the farm and his wife and his family, so they can't even use their car to drive to Bristol every day to report for bail. It just so happens that he's quite friendly with some anti-lockdown campaigners. So is this more blatant political policing from Avon and Somerset? And another Kill the Bill demo tomorrow, starting at 2 o'clock outside Bristol's council house. What are the two common purpose candidates for Mayor of Bristol? Labour's Blairite Marvin Rees and the Greens' privatised youth centres guru Sandy Hall Ruthven, both of whom refused to be interviewed for this show. Think, well, we don't know. We'll be asking Tom about the Kill the Bill. And academic freedom, Bristol University on the front line, a demonstration outside the Wills building this week in support of Bristol University sociology professor Dr. David Miller, accused of the hate crime of saying that Jewish student groups are not reflecting the spread of Jewish opinion but supporting the Israeli state instead. And he, it looks like, may get sacked from his job for saying that. And also, so after the successful test last week, I'm happy to say we should also now be streaming live on RadioQUK.com from Camberley. But joining us is Mayor candidate Tom Baldwin for the first half hour, 40 minutes or so. Tom, can you just tell us a little bit about TUSC? What does it stand for and what do you stand for?
Yeah, so TUSC is the Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition. It was founded in order to try and give a political voice to working class people who we feel have been abandoned by Labour. It is a coalition which involves groups like the RMT, the Rail and Maritime Transport Workers Union, and also the Socialist Party, which I'm a member of. We didn't stand candidates for a lot of the time in which Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party. But now under Starmer's leadership, we're finding a great deal of dissatisfaction with what Labour are offering people. And at a local level as well, we think it's important that there are candidates that are saying that councils don't have to carry out the cuts that the Tories are demanding of them. Local government budgets have been absolutely slashed in terms of the funding that they get from central government. COVID has obviously added additional pressures on the finance, and really every council of all political stripes have sought to make ordinary people pay the price for that by cutting jobs and services, and as they are in Bristol, by raising council tax. This year it's going up by close to 5%. And you know, what we think is necessary is a mass campaign of ordinary people standing up to the government and demanding that the money that's been taken from the city be restored. And, you know, I would be moving a budget based on what Bristol needs, not what the Tories are demanding of us.
There was a little bit of a quarrel, I don't know if you were following it, Tom, within the Labour group about the budget this year. Actually, I think it was Joe Sargent, maybe one or two others. One of them actually resigned eventually over it, feeling that they'd been bullied, having to vote for the, I think it was to do with the housing budget, to make sure that the actual rents around the council area rose in line with inflation so that they could afford to actually keep looking after council housing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I think the accusation that I've seen is that basically it was an election year trick to have a freeze on the rents, whereas they were arguing that the rents needed to be raised in order to cover the cost of repairs. I mean, you know, personally, I think I wouldn't like to see rents going up faster than wages are rising, which is slow at the moment for a lot of people, in fact, facing cuts to their living standards. That really, I mean, firstly, there's money in reserve in the housing revenue account that the council hasn't been spending on renovating council houses, which it should. But really, we've got to be looking beyond the very limited coffers of Bristol City Council and the even more limited resources of council tenants, and look into what the government's able to provide in this case. You know, what we've seen in the last 12 months is the enormous, you know, the billions of pounds of taxpayers' money that's been thrown at challenging coronavirus. I think, you know, rightly so, that had to be challenged. A lot of that, however, has ended up in the pockets of Tory donors through rather shady contracting practices. But, you know, what it proves is the country isn't as bankrupt as we've been told it was. The money is there when things are a priority. Well, council housing needs to be a priority. This city has a housing crisis. I think we don't just want to improve the quality of council housing, but we need to massively expand the amount of council housing.
Well, they are. I mean, the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, would argue, Tom, that they have been expanding council housing, and also that he's a Labour Party member. He's a socialist. We don't need the fringe left candidates like you around. People can just vote for him.
Well, I would say look at the man's record really as an answer to that. I mean, it's easier to say that you're a socialist, but you know, one of his first one of the very first things he did in office was to say that the financial situation is worse than we think, and we have to make 1,000 job cuts. And you know, that's no kind of socialism that I'm aware of. You know, putting that misery onto ordinary people. You know, I think my politics starts with we stand up for the working class, and work has got to stand up for ourselves. You know, you don't accept the first offer that you get from the government. You're able to change the parameters in which you're told you have to work by struggling. You know, I think without a struggle, we wouldn't have the right to vote. Most people in this country, the election itself would be null and void. But there's still the need to fight for those things that we need. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see a whole load more of that, with a big slew of job cuts coming, with a whole load of firms attempting fire and rehire practices in order to push people onto to worse contracts. And, you know, this city having a mayor that would stand on the side of those workers that are fighting back, I think would strengthen those struggles. I think that's also why it's at this time that the government have tried to bring this bill in order to curtail the right to protest, not because it's just something that they dislike, but because they know that it's something that they're going to be facing a considerable amount more of.
Martin, can I just bring you in on this? Because, I mean, surely this is perfect for the Tories to have the Labour split into left and right. And, you know, there's votes flying around like confetti on the left, but everyone is focused on trying to get the Tories in on the right.
Well, in the mayoral election, there is two votes. So it's perfectly feasible for people to vote for Tom if they agree with what he's just said, and much of which I do agree with. And then you've got a second vote as a sort of insurance policy to keep the Tories out. And, you know, you've got to use that as wisely as you can. Priti Patel, of course, is going to bring in first past the post elections for mayors and in all other elections, so that they basically realise that this is actually potentially harmful from their point of view. They're also going to gerrymander all the constituencies on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which we know are massively incomplete, particularly in poorer inner city areas. And they're also going to change, on the top of that, they're also going to change the boundaries. So they're going to gerrymander, they're going to reduce the number of MPs so they can balance it more as they see it. And, of course, as we saw in the budget, they've just chucked quite a lot of money at Tory marginal seats under the current setup. It's The other thing they're going to do is bring in, as in the US, in some states, that you've got to have you've got to have photo ID in order to be able to vote. 30% of the population haven't got photo ID. So they're actually trying to gerrymander the system completely. But in this particular election, people could vote for Tom with a clear conscience because you've got a second preference vote, which you should wisely use.
What would you make of the protests and the kill the bill? I actually call it the police state bill, because you're looking at some of the powers the police will be taking to themselves, particularly to confiscate people's homes, arrest people for trespassing, who literally have got nowhere else to go. I mean, we know, I mean, one of the most shocking things I've seen in the last few weeks is Marvin Rees, the Blairite Bristol mayor, who's standing for re-election, putting in his election manifesto and literature that he's opening up new sites for travellers, while the travellers tell me that they've been told in a few weeks' time, basically after the elections, those traveller sites could well be closed, and those travellers will then have nowhere to go and be liable to become criminals. I mean, we've got 20,000 people or so in Bristol who can't either afford to pay the rent or a mortgage, and it looks like this bill, Tom, is moving towards the I think it's called the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, is moving to criminalise, you know, actually we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people across the country.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's an incredibly draconian piece of legislation that's being brought forward. Labour nationally were minded not to even vote against that, but to abstain on that bill, as has been their pattern really for the entire duration of Keir Starmer's leadership. There is no effective political opposition at a national level in this country, in Parliament at least. They were kind of shamed really into moving their votes against it by the very heavy-handed way that the police intervened in the Sarah Everard vigils. But I think in Bristol, by the police provoking reaction from demonstrators by violently attacking a peaceful protest a couple of weeks ago, and then by the press largely covering that on the basis of look at these thuggish protesters and ignoring the role that the police have played, then they were able to try and change people's opinions a little bit. I think the events of the last kind of couple of weeks, really where the coppers have then overstepped the mark and gone in and attacked peaceful demonstrations on a couple more occasions and possibly raised some questions in people's minds about the kind of story you're getting about the original Sunday night events.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've also seen a change, though, in the law with regard to protests. Although, you know, I've seen people organising protests going over, having discussions with the police, pointing out the law line by line, and then the police going away. A lot of the time, they're just weighing in without even necessarily knowing what the law is, because they've been told to by Priti Patel. It's absolutely crucial to point out that The Guardian had a leaked memo from the Home Office showing and proving that Priti Patel directly ordered the police to weigh in to the Sarah Everard vigil on Clapham Common, which is an absolutely incredibly appalling thing to do under the cover of COVID. But that cover of COVID is now, as of last weekend, is gone. But anyway, look, I mean, one of the most horrific things that's happened over the last few weeks is this Tuesday before last, this police attack on 200 travellers who are about to be criminalised in this new law, and their supporters who were just literally sitting down singing songs, absolutely no warning whatsoever. In fact, they were even told by the police that that would be fine for them to stay there, and then at 10 o'clock, completely out of the blue, 100 riot police comes around the corner from the side of the council house and just charged into them. They lost lots and lots of gear. I was with them on Monday as they were picking it up, actually, from a vehicle that had gone to Bristol City Council's council house finally to go and pick up their stuff. There was stuff missing as well. Someone had had an accordion stolen, assumed by the people at the council, or maybe it had been destroyed and they were so embarrassed that they had to throw it away. But quite a lot of equipment missing and things like musical instruments gone, so people didn't get stuff back. You know, that's obviously going to be a subject of further requests to the police and to the council to get it back. But anyway, someone who was there is Jim from the Right to Reside campaign, and I had a chat with him earlier this week about his whole experiences, and he takes us through 5 minutes now of exactly what happened when the police decided to weigh in to a traveller and squatters completely and utterly socially distanced, marked up, masked up peaceful protest.
Right about 10 o'clock, I was inside a pod, and when the drone was up, you could see two red lights from the cathedral, like the tower, and you could see that, and then that had been watching us for quite a while, and it was more apparent when it got dark because it had two big red lights. Then a helicopter did a swoop and went round with a big white light and looked round, and then people said, hey, you've got to get out your sleeping bag here. And so I got out.
So who said that?
Other people that were, no. Other people around me said, you want to get out. You're like, there's loads of cops. I was just going to go sleep. I sleep rough. Yeah. So I sleep outside. So I was bedding down for the night. I was going to actually go sleep. Some other people doing a ceilidh and dancing around in a circle. That wasn't my thing. I just thought, all right, I'm just going to sleep now. I just like, all right, I've chatted, seen a lot of people, and now it's dark, and I'm going to go sleep. And then I got out of the sleeping bag, and I managed to pack all my bedding up, but I lost the pod, and but all my bedding was in a rucksack. And luckily, because I held on to it, a lot of people had been split and ran off and gone and split by the police that had come in. And I ended up with a group of people, so I kind of conformed to their ideal. They were all sat down. I didn't want to do that, but I sat down, and I linked arms, and other people suggested, and they linked arms with me as well. But I had my big rucksack, and I was on the edge, and it was all my bedding in there, so I had like a blanket, a quilt, and a sleeping bag. So it worked as quite good padding. But the police were coming around and flicking people. They flicked my hat off, and I spoke to somebody today, and their hat got flicked off. Someone was wearing like a costume and a wig, and they got their wig pulled off.
So the idea is to identify you?
Kind to identify you, but also like shouting at you and coming, disperse, disperse, and you're all sat down on the floor, but coming at you like aggressively, and then wanting you to respond. And so they're kind of like, as though they were trying to shift it to get a moral high ground if you lashed out. And I spoke to a girl today, and she kicked out. And because she kicked out and she was on the floor and she kicked out, they told her, she shouted at her and told her off for doing it. And then later she got beat. She got beat on the legs several times. So I walked away from it in the end. I was able to, like, there was only about 10 people left on 10, 15 of us left on a College Green, picking up tents that they trampled and tipped over and picked up people's stuff and we put it all over into one pile, thinking we can collect it later, or maybe the council will pick it up and we will get it back. And that seems to have materialised. Some of the stuff, people have got some of their stuff back.
So how many days later? This is nearly a week later.
Yeah, this is nearly a week later. They weren't told. This was on Tuesday night, and I think they were given information on the Friday, which is what we've heard, is that they've given information on the Friday that they can collect it from Days Road, which is a recycling centre.
Is anything missing?
Things that people said that went missing was anything like leaflet stickers and sort of posters or anything like that, sort of propaganda stuff, anything that was useful in that kind of way went. And the other thing was the sabotage. All the tent poles, all most of them, so methodically, that someone had gone through them and snapped them all so the tents can't be erected.
Is that an accordion missing?
I don't know about that.
That's what I was just hearing. Someone's accordion has just disappeared.
I don't know.
So any injuries of the people who were camping out?
I didn't get hit myself, but what they were doing is they were like coming in at you in such an aggressive way is that you might flinch or like do something that they might construed as that you're going on the attack, and then they then could justify themselves to go for you. But they seemed, a lot of them seemed very young, and it was like as though that kind of older, that old policeman saying, like, you've got to grow a moustache and look older and look more assertive. They were like kind of like young cops, like putting on a deep voice, like as though they were like an old guy.
Well, were they accents? Were they from? Were they Avon and Somerset?
I don't know. It was just, they weren't saying much words. It was really deep. It was like, disperse, disperse. But they were like really old, like as like an old school, like old guys, like kind of like in a choir, like a. Do you know what I mean?
Have you ever seen the Bristol Avon and Somerset police behaving like this?
Not really. I'm like in my mid-50s. I've seen the police like this with stuff like the poll tax possibly, but that was like much more heavier. The thing was had gone heavier. It was a riot. This was like people sat down on the grass. And obviously, I think they did this. It was like, it looks like the way that they came in, it was like as though it was sort of like they were going to trash it, like Battle of the Beanfield, like Travellers back in the mid-80s. It seemed as though they it was like they've been psyched that these people are evil, the way they live.
What do you think? What's the protest trying to achieve?
I think the protest was showing us sort of like people trying to visualise this to the general public. This is the people. This is the people that are being affected by this. Not in a sort of like you won't be able to go and walk on a Saturday, because that is affects people's kind of rights of what they can, restriction of where they can move. But if you stop people living a certain way, then maybe they haven't got any other way to live. Maybe they haven't got the means or the money, or they haven't got the land to be on.
Yeah, so that's Jim from Right to Reside there. He was at that. You know, for me, Martin, the most amazing thing about this is it's quite obvious that the police deliberately wade in where they didn't need to. They wanted to create this kind of battle, basically. So they could quite easily have said, given them, say, I don't know, half an hour to pack their stuff up and go with a warning that we're going to disperse you. But they didn't do that. They're weighing into a whole situation where people are just about to go off to sleep in their tents.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's going to happen with this bill is that every demonstration will become a potential source of conflict, because the police have been given powers in this bill. And it's very, very pernicious of the government to bring this forward when there's coronavirus regulations, whatever people think about that. They certainly shouldn't bring forward a very contentious bill about protest at a time when we're supposedly having a lockdown. That's very, very naughty of them. And of course, ultimately, people will protest, whatever the law says. And we could end up with a situation where there is a permanent state of conflict between particularly young people without work and prospects and the police, and well, rebirth of the 1980s.
Yeah, this is exactly what's going on, isn't it, Tom? Is that you've been to some of the demonstrations. I've seen you on the telly there with your megaphone. So many of the people, particularly in the evening protests, have been youngsters and students, loads of students down there I've seen.
Yeah, I've been at those demonstrations. I think it's very important to get out and make your voice heard for defending the vital right to protest. And I think, you know, a lot of those young people were there because they realised that protest was something that was going to be important to them over the coming years. They're students or not, they're looking at their prospects. And they're not seeing a great deal at the moment on the basis of this system and on the basis of this crisis. They're not offered a lot without fighting for it. And I think that's why people were there. And I would agree absolutely with the fact that, you know, that the police were deliberately trying to provoke confrontation in these events. And when they weren't able to provoke it, were themselves starting it. And I think, you know, the law, if it comes in the form in which it's written, is incredibly draconian. Essentially, it allows the outlawing of peaceful protest. It means that people can face a 10-year prison sentence for causing severe annoyance, which is something that isn't defined, but which, you know, any peaceful demonstration that marks through the streets and delays traffic could be said to be causing annoyance to those people that are delayed in their cars. If the police have the right to go in heavy-handed against any demonstration and make arrests on that basis, it massively increases the chances that they will deploy violence, and therefore that the situation will turn violent. And so, you know, I think it's a counterproductive piece of legislation in some ways, but it's, you know, it's not going to stop protest. People are going to have to protest because the things we're fighting for is a livelihood. It's things we can't do without. So it's not going to stop protest, but it is giving or seeking to give additional powers to the police to try and combat that. And I think it's absolutely right that we oppose it.
Quite a few people have pointed out that there seems to be a big change in the way the police have been behaving, particularly during the latter half of COVID, and certainly in Bristol with these massive attacks on peaceful protesters who are socially distanced and wearing masks, which is just really pretty shocking. I don't think we've ever seen that here in this country for a good long while, not in my lifetime. And one of the people who's making a fuss about this is a former inspector of Metropolitan Police. His name is Roy Williams, and he was interviewed by one of the demonstrator stroke organisers at one of the rallies in London about 2 weeks ago. And his name is Roy Williams. He's a former Met Police inspector, and he is not at all happy with the way the police are behaving these days.
Roy Williams. I'm a retired Metropolitan Police Inspector, believe it or not. I served my last 10 years of my service at Brixton Police Station, so I've been an operational copper all my life, pretty much.
And when did you come out of the service?
2008, I retired.
So, why are you here? What brings you here? What's your point on it?
I suppose two things, really. As far as I'm aware, the Bill of Rights Act and the Coronation Oath are still current acts of Parliament, and these give us fundamental constitutional rights to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, which it appears that Matt Hancock and Boris Johnson think they can override with a little bit of a ministerial diktat on the premise that there's some sort of health risk being provided by people gathering in groups. Everybody who's been given a ticket who pleads not guilty, the ticket is no further action. Possibly because they may need to provide the evidence that you're presenting a health risk. I don't know, I'm just guessing.
So, as an ex-policeman,
I'm absolutely appalled by what I see. I've seen some horrific things. In fact, in these demonstrations, these ongoing demonstrations, when I came to one in Hyde Park, I think in September, we saw some guy with a guitar running around, and I'm sure he was an annoyance to some of the police officers who were in riot gear and all the rest of it. However, one officer turned around and basically assaulted this guy, jumped on him, and then he was followed by six or seven other officers. Clearly an unprovoked assault. I made a complaint to the Metropolitan Police. It was never followed up. I never heard anything from anyone. I made a complaint about the fact that I'd not received any contact about the complaint, and again, no more contact. I phoned a control room and I laid it out for them. I told them exactly what I was complaining about, and I've heard nothing to date.
In normal times, not Corona times, that would be normally followed up, would it?
Absolutely. It appears to be a different kind of police force than what I was in, where we were there to serve members of the public. Seems that we're not doing that now.
Yes, I thought that was the oath, isn't it?
We swear an oath to the Queen. So our allegiance, when we swear that oath, is to the Queen.
But why do you think they're doing this? Why do you think the police are behaving like this or not speaking out?
Put under a lot of political pressure by the government. Absolutely,
sort of you do this or you lose your job thing?
Probably clear, isn't it?
Yeah,
I was stopped earlier by two officers where we assembled in Trafalgar Square, and I actually tried to confirm with the officers that the Bill of Rights and the Coronation Oath are still current pieces of legislation, and unfortunately they didn't want to listen to, they didn't want to enter into any discussion about that. I'm telling you, you're breaking the law or potentially breaking the law, and I'm going to give you your first warning. Came to the point I had to leave or be arrested, so I walked away. All I can say is that the intolerant, deaf-eared kind of approach of the police is, in my opinion, just ridiculous. You know, people are here today not because anybody organised it. We're here on an organic basis. People are coming here to stand up for the rights of people going back centuries. People died in wars for the rights we have today. And I don't see why, just because we have a government that's they're almost communist, should get away with what they're doing now.
Well, that's former Met Police Inspector Roy Williams accusing the police of being like communists at the end there. But it's fascinating what he's saying. I imagine that he's referring to the sort of the Stasi Eastern Europe, and the idea that you've got a kind of very top-down command control police force that does whatever it's told by politicians, Tom?
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the police primarily exist to protect capitalism, to protect the rule of the big business owning class, and they've always had the capacity to act in this manner, to deploy violence against people. We've seen that in the poll tax, which was mentioned, in the miners strike, in others. But I think, you know, there has been in the last couple of weeks, in particular that I've seen, but probably for a little bit longer, a bit of a marked change in tactics. And that comes as no accident at a time when the capitalist system is in crisis, and where perhaps they feel that they're going to need to use use brute force, really, to protect it much more than maybe was the case before. I think there's kind of three things behind the change in tactics deployed by Avon and Somerset police in recent weeks. So one of them, this bill itself, although it hasn't passed yet, it has clearly given a green light to police to act in a more aggressive manner. I think the criticism that they got from the Home Office and from Priti Patel over the policing of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations when the Colston statue was brought down has probably really acted as instruction that you've got to go in harder. But also I think that the COVID legislation as well, which, you know, I agree by and large with the needs for lockdown and things like that, but the very draconian and sweeping way in which it was written, that, you know, from I think November onwards, demonstrations were not exempt from the corona laws. Essentially, protests were banned, and that was what gave the police the kind of excuse to go in and to make blanket removals against people, and then use that to try and attack people and stir up violence. And I think, you know, there's a real hypocrisy in the way that legislation has been deployed, because outside you're far safer than you are inside, and yet there's a whole host of industries in which people have been forced into unsafe working conditions inside workplaces for 8-10 hours at a time, and the police powers haven't been used to do anything about that, because that's considered fine as long as you're there turning a profit for a boss. And, you know, where there has been improvements in health and safety, or the closure of, for example, schools in January, or other unsafe workplaces, it's been workers themselves that have had to organise and to win that. And so in terms of defending public safety and things like that, I would far rather trust that to be under the control, the democratic control of the working class, than really the diktats of Priti Patel and this Tory government and the hierarchy of the police as well.
Yeah, well, Martin, we've got these things called police and crime commissioners now, haven't we? The Labour guy is called Dan Norris, who was Tony Blair's whip that managed to get the vote pro.
Dan Norris is standing to be West of England mayor, isn't he?
Oh, is he? Is he? OK, sorry. Yes, you're right. The Metro mayor, that's right. Yeah. But anyway, what do you make of the role of the police and crime commissioners? Because this is an American-type system we've now got here. The idea is, supposedly, that they can rein the police in politically, but, you know, you're voting potentially anyway, although our Avon and Somerset commissioner, Sue Mount-Stevens, is supposedly an independent, although she's married to, or she was anyway, I don't know if he's still the chair of Business West. You've got these sort of semi-independents, and you've also got political parties putting forward candidates for police commissioner. I mean, it almost seems to me that we're bound to go in a more political direction with policing if you're going to have a police and crime commissioner who's elected for a political party.
Well, as you say, the police and crime commissioner idea came from the United States, as did the whole thing of having elected mayors. And it was a Cameron government's back of a fag packet idea. One place where they haven't brought in elected police and crime commissioners is in Northern Ireland, because for what would happen there is either a Republican would be elected, which would be unacceptable to the loyalists, or a loyalist would be elected, which would be unacceptable to the Republicans. So they didn't even dare to try it on there. And of course, the turnout for these elections is pitiful. Most people don't know what they do, can't be bothered to find out what kind of role they will fulfil. And as you know, we used to have Police Federation spokespeople coming onto the show saying that they thought it was a totally stupid idea, because ultimately, what can they do? If they're going to stick their finger in and push the police in a certain direction, then that's interference in the police's decision making. And if they're not going to do that, then what are they there for? And of course, what the Tories really hoped is that their police and crime commissioners, if they were Tories, would be bullying the police to get harder on travellers, to clear nuisances from the streets, you know, stop the homeless protesting, etc. And they wanted to create a mechanism for that to work through. And it's basically it's just a cockamamie system, frankly.
Anyway, I spoke this week to one of the police and crime commissioner candidates for Avon and Somerset in the May election, and his name's Mark Shelford. He's a former army officer, but I thought it'd be interesting to ask him about his service in Afghanistan and Northern Ireland, because as I pointed out to him, you've got a massive explosion in the drugs trade with the poppies in Afghanistan. And then there's all these revelations about the horrific collusion between the army in Northern Ireland and the loyalist terrorists.
Part of my remit, in fact, was to deal with anti-drugs. It's a really interesting question, actually, because one of the things... So poppy grows extremely well in Afghanistan. It doesn't need a huge amount of water, and it can cope with the really quite significant changes in the weather that people in Afghanistan face. And one of the things that I was arguing for within the headquarters was to legalize the growing of poppy for pharmaceutical opium, so morphine, for example. But it was a really big political discussion argument, and I certainly didn't win it. But we had very large anti-drugs operations that went on, including a significant amount of money ploughed into trying to get the farmers to change to other types of crops that they could sell. The advantage, of course, to them of growing opium is that wet opium you can put in a black dustbin bag and bury in the ground, and it can stay there for a significant amount of time, you know, beyond 18 months. It will still be very good, and then can be processed by the drugs trade. So it was a really difficult battle to have across the spectrum. So it was interesting, and one learned an awful lot about it.
What about Northern Ireland then? Also, because the British Army has been accused, it'd be interesting to see what you think, of collusion with the loyalist paramilitaries during the Troubles.
Well, I certainly didn't experience that during my time. And I certainly, I'm aware of what I've read the newspapers like you have, I've seen it in the newspapers. I never experienced that on the ground when I was there. And but it is terrible to hear that did happen. And isn't it fantastic that we've got peace there now? Because that's what we all want.
Yeah, and I also, I mean, he made it quite clear he supports the Priti Patel bill, but he didn't seem to know much about the fact that there was all this stuff criminalising travellers in it. And I suppose it's impossible to know everything about everything that's going on. But anyway, I also asked him about what, for me, has been always, you know, when we've had the previous police and crime commissioner elections, the most important side of all of this, which is white-collar crime. It's all very well the police going around beating up and arresting travellers, but what about the white-collar criminals, people, for example, in the city council who are fraudulently selling off bits of land to their mates for vast sums, but also particularly the problem with Lloyds Bank on Castle Park, the business support unit, which the BBC recently reported. There was accusations of very serious fraud there that hadn't even been investigated, let alone prosecuted, a similar kind of fraud that was going on in Reading, which has put a whole load of Lloyds bankers behind jail, where they had a Thames Valley police took a rather more robust attitude than our lily-livered Avon and Somerset to these white collar crimes. So this is a second clip with Mark Shelford now, where I talked to him about white collar crime in Bristol and what he prepared to do about it.
I've had a number of victims approach me about the fact that they haven't been properly looked after by Avon and Somerset, and it's certainly something that I want to look into as soon as I take over, if I'm elected in. I absolutely do want to look into this. I mean, if we look at the totality of cybercrime and fraud within the UK, it is doubled every year for the last 3 years, to a total of 154 million odd at the moment. There are an awful lot of victims out there that we really need to look into. And I'm not sure Avon and Somerset have got the capability to do that at the moment. And as part of my manifesto, one of the things I want to form is a cyber crime unit to look into this. And one of the things that has been suggested to me is that we hire, or we recruit rather, forensic accountants and IT experts to form a local Southwest group to support the National Crime Agency, but specifically both in fraud and cybercrime, because it is so significant at the moment.
But there's even accusations that Lloyds Bank have got specific detectives, friendly detectives, that are working with them very closely and with their lawyers in order to make sure that there are no prosecutions of people working there. I mean, you may know that in Reading, Lloyds were prosecuted. They were using this money that they had effectively been defrauding their borrowers from, for things like foreign holidays, sex parties, this sort of thing. And the accusations are that a similar thing has been going on in Bristol. It's just that the Thames Valley Police had the temerity to prosecute and to actually investigate, whereas Avon and Somerset simply haven't.
And I think it is absolutely outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. And I am, as I said, I have been approached by a significant number of these victims. I think there are over 200 in Avon and Somerset. And I think there are their cases need looking at. And I'm so surprised that the current regime of the current PCC and her deputy have not forced these investigations. And I don't understand why not.
There are other problems with white-collar crime, and I'm going to focus on this for a little while, actually, Mark, because we've had another deal with Legal & General over the sell-off of the land at Temple Island for a massive property development. Now, we all know that these are incredibly lucrative deals when you're selling off public land, for example, and even things to do with allowing planning permission in exceptional cases can make be an absolute bonanza for the person that gets that planning permission. But particularly land deals like Temple Island, which many journalists around the city have questioned as to whether it's even legal to be doing a deal with a specific individual without allowing other companies to tender for a deal. Now, some have said that this is corrupt. Some have said it's fraud. And, of course, there's a large amount of money involved. What do you make of the ability or not of the police to investigate these claims?
Well, I'm clear that the current capability of Avon Somerset is not enough. And that's why a lot of these victims have not had their cases looked into. And it's not just the numbers, but it's also the experience and knowledge. And that's something that I'd like to focus on and make sure we have a better capability to look at all of these things. I think it's you have the stories of the victims that come to you, and they're heartbreaking, and you just can't understand why they haven't been properly investigated.
But what I'm talking about here is property deals involving Bristol City Council, and simply not allowing there to be tendering for. It's almost as if there's been little chit chats in a London club, or in I wouldn't say down the pub, obviously during COVID, but You know, the somewhere on the back of a fag packet, a little deal has been drawn up between the council and Legal and General to do this site without it being properly tendered out. This is now the problem with this sort of. There's been quite a lot of news stories written about this, including the leak of all the documents which the council tried to redact to do with that deal, but then they didn't manage to do it properly, and some technical whiz kid stripped out the black from over the top and managed to find out what was underneath it in some kind of peculiar electronic fashion. But of course, the point here is that it's the city council is one of the most important contributors to the police's budget. Do you think Avon and Somerset Police are really up for investigating the people that pay their wages?
Well, let's be clear. Let's separate out a couple of things here. First of all, I completely agree that if there's been fraud at this level, as you have alleged and others have alleged, then it needs to be thoroughly investigated and proved, irrespective of who it is that has committed this alleged fraud. In other words, the police must investigate without fear or favour. That's the first thing. The second thing, the city council do not pay the wages of the police. It is the residents who, through their council tax, pay that precept, as well as a central government grant and other grants. And it's very important that we don't think it's the city council or any other district council or unitary council that pay the wages of the police. That's not the case, and they are not beholden to them. And to defend the police, absolutely I will. They are absolutely not beholden to them. That means that they should, if there is a legitimate case, they should investigate with all means possible.
Well, yes, they should, but will they? That's the question. Well, what do you make of this, Tom? The idea that that the council pay the wages of the police and therefore the police might be a bit reluctant to investigate them as they would, say, for example, a traveller parked on the side of the road.
Well, I don't know about the specifics of the kind of police funding. I mean, I think it's collected through the council tax, but not kind of paid by the council is my understanding. But very clearly, there is a disparity in the way that justice is dispatched in this country, really done on class lines, basically. If you're very wealthy, you're far more likely to get away with things than if you're not. It's as simple as that. And there tends to be a greater overlooking of, you know, like you say, white-collar crime. I think a good example would be some of the COVID contracts where Matt Hancock, the health secretary, has admitted to not going through the normal scrutiny process on some of the contracts he gave away. One of those included for PPE, I think it was, provided by the landlord of his local pub. And so, you know, that there's very clear opportunities for fraud and for backhanders, and you know, largely that's left without scrutiny, whereas ordinary people I think would find themselves under far greater scrutiny from that. So, you know, like I say, that the role of the police is one of the arms of the state. Fundamentally, they do exist to protect this system. Now, you know, public safety and policing of crime that affects ordinary people, those are things probably that people would want to keep done. But I think that can and must be done under democratic control and accountability. And the police and crime commissioner system falls very, very short of that. I mean, you know, I've never heard a word from Sue Mount-Stevens in the last 5 years or so that she has been in that post. Don't know what she's been saying to police chiefs, if anything. Really, there's no more accountability over her than there is over the police themselves. You know, yet to hear what she thinks about the violence that the police have deployed in the last couple of weeks. And it's an election in which the deposit is £10,000 to stand. So they've made a very clear play at freezing out all but the wealthiest independent and smaller parties So, you know, it's I think an attempt to attach a kind of facade of democracy to really the same old system that we've
That's had. A really good point, Tom, about the deposit. Martin, I mean, this also, you know, you've got increasingly these protests are actually about the police themselves, not about other things that are going on in society so much as you're literally out there saying that we don't want the police to have these extra powers. There's something rather sinister, isn't there, about trying to stop protests which are actually about the police themselves and using the police to do it.
Well, I think this could come back to bite the government in the bum, really, because as we've seen happening in Bristol, one demonstration has led to further demonstrations, and it's now becoming a trial of strength between those who are opposed to the bill and the police. And if this bill is passed and these powers are given to the police, then there will be a structural confrontation between protesters of all stripes and the police. The police may very well say to a picket line or to some other protest that they've got to disperse or whatever, but they won't necessarily, that people are not going to go because they're not necessarily going to accept the police's authority.
Yeah,
and of course, authority of the police, Martin, in protest, I mean, just depends an awful lot.
Well, Martin, just to interject, because what we've been witnessing over the last few years is the police saying, well, certain demonstrations are okay, even doing sort of little dances with the demonstrators on the Extinction Rebellion on the Bristol Bridge, and others are not. So this is a real worry that this is becoming much more of a political police system that Priti Patel's taking us into. I would remind listeners that Priti Patel is a traitor to the British nation. You know, whether or not you're a nationalist person, she went over to a private holiday and had 12 meetings back in Theresa May's era in 2017 with various Israeli government officials and heads of charities over in Israel, where they were lobbying her, for example, to give, which is when she was International Development Secretary, to give British taxpayers money to the Israeli government, the Israeli army in the Golan Heights, for example. So this is the woman who is now heading the Home Office in one of the most incredible changes to the police that I've seen in my lifetime, where they're becoming increasingly very much political, deciding which demonstrations they will police and which ones they won't. And also this week, surprisingly, the police turned up at a farm run by Joe and Dion Drayson in between Bath and Frome at Norton St Philip on Tuesday morning, very, very early. Dion Drayson is a former British Army weapons instructor, and he runs a whole load of cabins there for post-traumatic stress disorder for former soldiers. Apparently, somebody had told the police that they had weapons there, live weapons of some sort, which were unlicensed. So this was a very draconian raid. But anyway, I spoke to Joe Drayson earlier this week, just after she'd been released from 36 hours in custody, to tell us what happened. What was this all about when she was raided on very early on hours of Tuesday morning?
It was about 4 to 5 in the morning. Dion woke me up and said, there's armed police outside. So I jumped up, I grabbed the puppy that was in the house, who's, 6 months old. I grabbed him and the police are just screaming, basically, open the door, you're surrounded, armed police, blah, blah. I said, I've got to put this dog in the cage because I didn't want to open the door and him run out and then shoot him. So I grabbed the puppy and put him in the cage, came out and they were like, put your hands up. Turn round backwards, come down the steps, blah de blah. Did all that. Then myself, I was put in the back of a police car, handcuffed, put in the back of a police car. Nobody had told me what was going on, why we were being arrested or anything. I was then carted off to Keynsham Police Station, where I was then told I was under arrest for Section 1 and Section 5 under the Firearms Act 1968. And I said to the WPC, well, what's that? And she said, well, I don't know. The first 24 hours, and then they extended it another 12 hours, and they tried to extend it, but the magistrates court turned them down because they said, no, you haven't found anything. You've got to let these people go, basically. So we were in for 36 hours. But they did then release us. So we've been released. We're on bail. And we've got to report into police station Bridewell police station in Bristol, which is it's a 2-hour round trip. We've got to report in every single day between 12 and 2. They told me this morning at 11 o'clock they were going to give me my car back because I got to sign in between 12 and 2. So I thought, well, that's okay. If they give my car back at 11 o'clock, but they didn't, they haven't given it back now. So I had to get a lift into Bristol.
I know Dion is ex-forces, isn't he? May have played some part in this.
He was the only weapons instructor in the country and for certain weapons at one point, but very, very professional and very, very conscientious.
Surely you can understand that the police might be concerned about such a place where firearms might be unregistered.
No. Basically, everyone that comes to the camp is checked beforehand. We get their army number. We look into them. We make sure that they're kosher. Nobody would be allowed to bring anything dangerous onto the site. It's not firearms. It's only pellet guns that they bring.
And what about Dion? I mean, has he got any registered firearms?
No, he hasn't, no.
Well, surely why not? I mean, as someone that's worked with guns in the army, it's kind of normal to keep guns in the countryside, surely.
About 12 years ago, they disarmed all the elite and Dion was one of them. His shotgun license was taken away. He was awarded it back in court by the judge, but he never got his guns back. And I mean, Dion hasn't even ever got a parking ticket or anything like that. He's completely squeaky clean. But yes, most of the elite were disarmed about 12 years ago.
So it sounds to me as if someone who's an expert in using firearms is less likely to get a firearms license than, say, someone like me.
Yes, I know. And this is what's so disgusting about it, because he's so conscientious and so professional, he should be one of the people that are allowed the licenses, really. I'm blocked off everything at the moment. They've seized my phone. They've seized the bank cards. They've seized... they've seized all our cash. We've got nothing. We've got no communication with the outside world at the moment. Nobby, have you got a YouTube at the moment that you're covering this story on? Little V on TV. You can follow that. Active Patriot, is he Active Patriot? And also Phil Watkins live feeds and demos, and Katie Jane, which is Children's Matter News.
That's Joe Drayson there speaking to me yesterday about just having been released after being arrested very early hours of Tuesday morning. Tom, the problem here is that, although it shouldn't be, is that the person that put me in touch with this story is an anti-lockdown campaigner. There's a political angle to this, isn't it? If they think that ex-forces people might have guns, be connected with an anti-lockdown person, you know, this looks to me almost as if we're going to be... It's a politically motivated. It's a bit of police paranoia. They think that this guy, because he's connected with anti-lockdown people... is going to be breaking the law. And so they've just shut him down for the week, taken all of his, stopped him getting access to his house, even though they haven't actually found anything incriminating there at all.
I'm going to be honest, I can't really comment on this. Prior to the start of this programme, I'd not heard of this case at all. So I've not really any of the facts to be able to make an informed comment on about it. Oh, sorry.
That's all right. That's fine. Martin, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, it's the first time I've heard about it as well. It seems like the police have got the wrong end of the stick here completely, because as the lady was saying, we don't have any weaponry here at all. So what are they on about?
Well, I suppose they may just turn something up. Who knows? But anyway, it just seems to me a very draconian way of dealing with this situation, particularly since, you know, they could, for example, they could give them, if they really think they need to have daily bail, they could go to Keynsham Police Station. Why make them go all the way to Bristol and not even give them their car? There's a certain sort of spite in the police here that the magistrate is quite rightly, made sure that the police are releasing them and not keeping them for a long period of time in jail. But one of the last local stories we're going to look at today is the demonstration against David Miller. Or, sorry, not against him, but against the people who are trying to get him sacked up at Bristol University. David is one of the world's top sociology lecturers, professors and authors. I mean, he's someone I've been aware of for many years as a journalist, started something called Spinwatch, which is a brilliant resource for journalists. Not that many journalists actually use it, but it's there anyway. And Spinwatch gives you various profiles of all these sort of experts that you see on TV. And explains where their funding has been coming from. But the reason that I thought it was particularly nice to cover this week is because Ron Mandel, who's Jewish and a former politics international relations lecturer, he also does a bit of one-to-one tutorials in his retirement, and he was on our show when we were on BCFM before Pat Hart, the chummy pal of Bristol's Blairite mayor, Marvin Rees, booted us off the radio as station manager of Bristol's so-called community FM. Anyway, Ron Mandel was on our program from time to time quite a bit, actually, as our main guest, for example, when Martin couldn't make it. And here is Ron at the David Miller demonstration on Wednesday, organized outside the Wills building at Bristol University.
I'm now going to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Ron Mandel, who's an academic. Thank you very much, Ron.
Thank you, Esther. I'm here to speak about academic freedom, a fundamental principle of university life. As an academic, I could never envision going into a classroom without feeling free to express my views and to teach in a way that would stimulate discussion, if not debate. Likewise, the research I conducted had to be free of any supervision, any censorship. That's fundamental to academic freedom. What underpins academic freedom is what is at the core of university life. As academics, we're expected to challenge conventional wisdom, to come up with new ideas, to encourage people to think for themselves. That's so fundamental, and it can never be fully understood unless you actually are an academic or you are a student at university. But I found in doing some background reading for today's talk a really amazing fact. There is no statutory right of academic freedom in this country. The University College Union, which I'm a member of, I used to be a member of the National Executive Committee, was branch secretary for 15 years at the University of Northampton. They conducted a study in 2017. They surveyed 2,300 academics. And what they found in that course of that study was a very chilling picture. 25% of academics felt they had less academic freedom now than they did when they were first hired. Universities were losing autonomy to basically function freely of government regulation. And even more disturbingly, 23% of academics felt they were being harassed, if not bullied, for expressing their views on controversial subjects. Now, in the case of David Miller, he's been held to account, so to speak, for making remarks which have been twisted out of shape and distorted and actually misrepresented, when he actually suggested that Israel was using Jewish societies at universities as a way to promote support for Israel. I think that is well established, and if so, is well established that the Israeli government has transgressed on Palestinian human rights now for decades. To accuse him of being anti-Semitic is conflating criticism, just criticism of the Israeli government, with prejudice against Jews. I'm happy to say that a week ago, 200 scholars, Jewish scholars from Israel, the UK, and the United States, issued a declaration. It's called the Jerusalem Declaration. And that declaration distinguishes criticism of Israel from anti-Semitism. and clears the way for activists to argue even for BDS and without being alleged to be anti-Semitic. I want to conclude. We're here today to defend David Miller, but we're here also to defend the higher principles of academic and free expression. Even if we did not agree with David Miller, I would be here to defend his right to express his views. Thank you for listening.
Yes, Ron Mandel there, speaking on Wednesday. Martin, it's interesting that so many of the people who came to speak actually themselves are Jewish. What David Miller has been accused of is a hate crime against Jews for saying that the university network of many of these Jewish groups are actually much more loyal to the Israeli state than they are to Jews more generally.
Well, I think that it's quite clearly the case that the Jewish societies and universities openly say that they're pro-Israel. That's perfectly okay. I haven't got a problem with that. They're entitled to their view. What they're not entitled to do is to silence other people who don't agree with them. And I mean, it's really ironic, is it not, that we've got Gavin Williams and the Tory press up in arms about freedom of speech in universities and how controversial right-wing figures aren't being allowed are being cancelled by woke culture, etc. Meanwhile, are totally respected. And, you know, and of course, David Miller is a bit of an expert on a lot of all these things. And he's going to be potentially put out of his job by a hate campaign orchestrated against him. And it's quite clear that the Israeli government, they spend an awful lot of money in pursuing these kind of vendettas. And, you know, it's absolutely disgraceful, really.
Yeah, the interesting thing about David in many ways is he is like the world expert on Islamophobia. And he points out time and time again in his books, in his lectures, etc., the massive amount of Islamophobia which goes through on the Nod, where as soon as somebody is criticising Israel, literally everything stops. There's a massive campaign to get whoever it is that said it sacked.
Yeah, well, it's obviously the reason why the Israeli state does these things through its proxies is because it works. Lots of people, for every brave David Miller who's going to stand up and call it out, possibly at the expense of their livelihood, there'll be plenty of weaker spirits thinking, look, I'm just going to have to stay out of this because I can't afford to say what I really think because I've got a mortgage to pay and I've got kids.
Yeah.
And that is why they do it.
Well, that's the way it always works. Only a few are prepared to speak out in those situations. Then, Tom Baldwin from Trade Union Socialist Coalition has had to go. He's had his hour. Well done, Tom. Thank you very much for joining us. But we're going to hear now from Tina Berkman, who's from a group called Labour Against the Witch Hunt. And Martin, maybe you can just explain why this term witch hunt, which is, you know, quite a strong word to use, is being used in this context.
Well, it's possibly not as visible to non-members of the Labour Party as it is to members. There is clearly a situation of heavy manners going on, and lots of people are being suspended and expelled for supposedly anti-Semitic views, and not just that, but it's got bound up with the treatment of Jeremy Corbyn and so on. And
this was happening during Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, this isn't something that's just started now Keir Starmer's taken over, is it?
No, but what's happened is the right wing of the party now feel that they have the whip hand. And they're not that bothered if people resign, because that's what they want them to do. And basically, they're doing everything they can to make the Labour Party an unhappy, unwelcoming place for Corbyn supporters and those of a similar orientation. And I think they're going to come unstuck with this. There was no particular reason for Starmer to take that kind of line. He could have taken a more balanced view. But he's nailed his colours to the mast now, and the rowing will go on, and a lot of it's going to end up in court.
And it's not Kerry McCarthy we're talking about. It's Senator McCarthy. That's the sort of image which is the witch hunt, you know, when McCarthy in the States was going after the Reds under the bed.
Yes. I mean, I think there's always been political differences in the Labour Party. That's common knowledge. But what's actually happening now is the deprival. I mean, for example, I've paid my subs to the Labour Party every month since 1975. So I've paid money, which has then been given to the party officials who claimed that the party was anti-Semitic. The party took legal advice. This is when Corbyn was the leader. And the legal advice was that they didn't have a case. But the party paid them off, a quite substantial payoff, using my money. And I resent that.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Tina Bergman from Labour Against the Witch Hunt, where she gives a pretty, I think, comprehensive explanation of why the case against Professor David Miller by Bristol University, looking into whether or not he should stay working here in Bristol. It gives it she does a pretty good discussion around why it's so important. And she, by the way, is German, as I think she says here.
Our next speaker has travelled all the way from Sheffield, Tina Berkman from Labour Against the Witch Hunt. Thank you, Tina. Thank you, comrades. Yes, the accent is German, if you're wondering. I want to start by saying we're here to support David Miller. Of course we are. But we have to be very clear, this is not actually about David Miller, is it? It's about something far, far more dangerous and serious than that. This is a whole widespread attack on free speech, academic freedom, the right to protest. They're all going hand in hand and are being organized by an increasingly authoritarian government. This is also not about Jewish students feeling unsafe about what David Miller has said or hasn't said. I think that's actually nonsense. I used to be a student, and I could really well handle arguments and disagreeing with people, etc. And I presume most students at Bristol University can actually manage that as well. And it's not students of Professor Miller's who've complained against him. We should be clear about that. So this is about brutal attacks on free speech in Palestine and academic freedom, especially on the subject of Palestine and Israel. This is why we set up the Labour campaign for free speech and helped to organise this protest. These attacks, to a large degree, are actually a response to the success of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, which has spread across the globe and which criticizes Israel and has become a real headache for the governments of Israel and the US, of course. And they're also, these attacks are a response to what happened in 2015. Do you remember what happened in 2015? When all our hopes went through the roof and a certain Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party, an anti-imperialist, an anti-war activist, who made it clear he will not follow, you know, the government into a war on Iraq or any other military adventures in the Middle East. He was a serious headache. He was presenting a serious headache to the establishment in Britain as well as abroad in the US and Israel. The Israeli government and its supporters in Britain put an immense amount of pressure and money and power behind an incredibly successful campaign to discredit Jeremy Corbyn and anybody who supports Palestine. This was the most devastating and the most devastatingly successful smear campaign in recent history, I believe. Dozens, hundreds of anti-racists were smeared as racists. They were smeared as anti-Semites, had their livelihoods really threatened. A number of people have lost their jobs for speaking out against Israel. Their reputations shattered, their political careers ruined, etc. You name it. Because their pro-Palestinian views were smeared as being anti-Semitic. And as the speaker before me said, the IRA misdefinition of anti-Semitism has been absolutely crucial in this context. We're now seeing every university that refuses to adopt it being threatened with defunding by the government. This is really, really serious. Even its author, Kenneth Stern, has said that this definition or misdefinition of anti-Semitism has been misused and has been used to chill free speech, as he put it. And that is very serious. It does conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. Criticism of Israel is labeled anti-Semitic, and that is a really big problem. In the US, you would have seen there's threats now against
charities that speak up on Palestine are being labeled anti-Semitic, including the really revolutionary Oxfam charity is labeled anti-Semitic and threatened with defunding, etc. This is a very serious attack. So the campaign against David Miller has to be seen firmly in this international context. He's an important test case, actually. If he loses his job, it could literally open the floodgates to many more academics. Other people have already lost their jobs. He's not the first. He wouldn't be the first. But this is the first attempt to get rid of an academic, and that has really serious implications for academic freedom. And if we look at what he actually said, just like Ken Livingstone, he's actually being criticized and hounded for something which is pretty much true. Remember Ken Livingstone mentioned the historic fact that Zionists in Germany cooperated with the early Nazi movement in the 30s to get Jews to Palestine. This is true. There's historic evidence, masses of it, but it's not allowed to say these historic facts at the moment. So David Miller also, he merely stated pretty unexciting and obvious fact that JSOCs and the Union of Jewish Students are acting in support of the Israeli government. It's not a secret. That's why they exist. That's the point of their existence. In their constitution, it states, their core values include inspiring Jewish students to make an enduring commitment to Israel. The Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, has shown that the Israeli government helps to fund the Union of Jewish Students. So it's not a secret, actually. We should note in this context that the JSOCs and Union of Jewish Students do not represent all Jewish students. They probably don't even represent a minority of Jewish students, even though if they pretend to. But there are thousands of secular and non-Zionist and even anti-Zionist Jews and Jewish students who are outraged about the crimes that are being committed by the Israeli government against the Palestinians. And it's just like in wider society, the Board of Deputies does not represent Jews in Britain. They keep saying it. It's not true. There are thousands, tens of thousands, anti-Zionist Jews who stand in solidarity with the Palestinians and criticize the Israeli government. And of course, many supporters of David Miller are Jewish, and many of his students are Jewish and support him. There's a letters of support on his website, and I urge you to check it out. So the attacks on David Miller and for academic freedom bring a danger which I think is the most serious, actually, and which we've noticed when putting together this rally. It's the danger of self-censorship, and that's, of course, what this is all about, to get people to shut their mouth. Shut your mouth about Palestine. Shut your mouth about what's going on in the Middle East, and just keep quiet. You know, it'll be okay. You'll keep your job. We'll keep it quiet, etc. That's why we're here today. We will not be silenced. We refuse to let anti-Palestine campaigners smeared as anti-Semites. We refuse to let somebody like David Miller stand by himself. We're in solidarity with David Miller, and we're in solidarity with Palestine. Thank you.
So that's Tina Berkman there from Labour Against the Witch Hunt, Martin. I mean, she's made a pretty comprehensive defence of Miller. Do you think he's going to be sacked or not?
It's hard for me to say because I don't really know what the politics are in Bristol University and who's got the whip hand. It's interesting that the University College, the Imperial College London, they refused to accept the definition of anti-Semitism, which was being pushed by Gavin Williams. Gavin Williams has said that all universities have got to sign up to this definition of anti-Semitism, which basically says criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. But lots of universities, some have signed up for it, but lots of universities have not, because they've taken legal advice that they're legally obliged to protect freedom of speech. And I think this is going to end up in the courts and the government is going to lose. But then, of course, they'll say, well, we'll have to get rid of the courts then, won't they?
I thought it was fascinating on Wednesday that so many of the speakers were either German or Jewish.
Well, it's not that surprising, really. What we're seeing here in Britain is not dissimilar to what we saw in the 1930s in Germany. We're gradually seeing a demonisation of dissent, a rampant Islamophobia on the back of terrorist atrocities which are probably being cultivated by our own intelligence services. This is crypto-fascism, isn't it?
Our final clip, anyway, is from the David Miller demo on Wednesday, is a woman called Sandy Kennedy from Brighton, whose parents were both killed in the Holocaust. She is, of course, Jewish. And here she is giving her to Hay Panthers why she thinks that David should definitely not lose his job if we're living in a free country.
I have a special message for those Jewish students at Bristol who consider themselves to be unsafe. Let me take you back to Yad Vashem. There's a picture of a little boy. He's about four. He's rolling up his arm to show that he has been branded. It's about 1943. The little boy is trying to look very brave, as little boys of four sometimes do. And now I'm going to take you to another little boy. 2 years ago in Hebron, trying to go through one of the checkpoints. Believe me, the checkpoints are not the turnstiles that get you into the lavatory. The checkpoints are cruel iron gates with soldiers on the other side with guns. That little boy is holding the hand of his little sister. He too is trying to be very brave. Now, Jewish students in Bristol, that is being unsafe. Unsafe is being in the suits with the settlers throwing their trash cans over you. Unsafe is being the students who try to stand up in Israel for what is right. Being unsafe is for the soldiers that break the silence. That is unsafe. Thank you.
So that's Sandy Kennedy from Brighton, whose parents both died in the Holocaust, talking about this whole idea of the Jewish students in Bristol apparently feeling unsafe, Martin.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's patently rubbish, isn't it? As I said before, and as was pointed out by the previous speaker, it's in the constitution of the Union of Jewish Students that they support the State of Israel. Now, I don't have any problem with that. Of course, many Jews do not support the State of Israel. Many Jews aren't members of the Union of Jewish Students, but I've got no problem with them organising or even taking money from the Israeli government. If that's where the money comes from, then perhaps they should be allowed to take it. But what they are doing is saying that people who are pro-Palestinian haven't got similar rights. And surely that's got to be the way of it. They can put their case for pro-Israel, and others are going to put the opposite case. That's what universities are for.
Before we finish talking about the Holocaust, let's have a listen, though, to Prince Charles, who just literally about 2 weeks before this lockdown business started in 2020, in February, he was over at Yad Vashem, who at the World Holocaust Forum 2020, where he gave the address. It was quite fascinating because this was one of the biggest gatherings of world leaders we have ever seen on planet Earth for the World Holocaust Forum, and why not? But I just thought it'd be interesting to hear what Prince Charles had to say and whether he was making the comparisons that so many others have made with the treatment of Muslims, and particularly of the Palestinians, by the Israeli government. Anyway, so this part of it is just a short extract of that talk by Prince Charles. Amazing as well that most of these people all over the world, he was the only actual aristocrat or, a king or queen or whatever, prince, to be there. Most of the rest of them all over the world were prime ministers. So I guess he was kind of standing in for Boris at the time. Anyway, so here is Prince Charles addressing the World Holocaust Forum 2020.
It has been a singular privilege throughout my life to have met so many Holocaust survivors who were welcomed to the United Kingdom and who began new lives there, contributing immeasurably to the welfare of our country and the world in the years that followed. I have such inspiring memories of remarkable people such as Anita Lasker-Wolfish, who somehow survived both Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen before moving to Britain after the war. There, as a wonderfully talented cellist, she co-founded the English Chamber Orchestra, of which I am proud to have been patron for the past 43 years. On her arm, she bears the number by which tyranny had sought to make her less than human. Yet through her music, she reminds us of the greatest beauty of which we are capable. Over the years, she has shared her story bravely and powerfully, determined that some good might come from the unspeakable evil she endured and overcame. From the horror, she brought harmony, healing, and hope. Just as each life lost in the Shoah stands for all the millions who died, each inspirational story such as that of Anita Lasker Wallfisch stands for the strength of spirit, the unparalleled courage, the determined defiance of the very best of humanity when confronted with the very worst. For my own part, I have long drawn inspiration from the selfless actions of my dear grandmother, Princess Alice of Greece, who in 1943, in Nazi-occupied Athens, saved a Jewish family by taking them into her home and hiding them. My grandmother, who is buried on the Mount of Olives, has a tree planted in her name here at Yad Vashem and is counted as one of the righteous among the nations. Chassidei Umot Olam. A fact which gives me and my family immense pride.
So that's Prince Charles speaking just before the pandemic started in 2020 over in Israel at the World Holocaust Forum. But Martin, you know, it's all very well talking about, you know, the good can come from evil. But actually what's really going on, isn't it, is that there are, you know, we're in a situation now where Palestinians might need to find somewhere to hide from the Israeli police rather like, you know, Prince Charles's grandmother, was it, I think, was hiding Jews in Athens.
Well, it's funny that he mentioned the Mount of Olives there. Now, when the State of Israel was created in 1948, its capital was to be at Tel Aviv, which is, in fact, historically Jaffa, and Jerusalem was definitely not to be part of the Israeli state. But, of course, by various wars and provocations, Jerusalem has been annexed by the Israeli state as part of Israel. But of course, that is in defiance of the agreement by which the State of Israel was established. In other words, it's as if Serbia was saying that we can have Kosovo. And of course, basically, the Israelis get away with stuff like that, which wouldn't be tolerated by the Serbs.
Well, I wonder if anybody at these Holocaust memorial events dares to mention the treatment of the Palestinians. You know, the apartheid certainly, you know, is something that was picked up from South Africa and is now we've got an even stronger form of apartheid over in Israel at the moment. But no discussion about that. It's a bit like mentioning, you know, Princess Diana in Prince Charles's presence.
Well, I mean... The Israeli state.
Well, I mean, is these things are taboo.
Uses
what happened, but they're very important, history. Aren't they? Why is it so taboo to discuss the situation now?
Well, because the Israeli state is a very powerful nuclear armed state, supported by the world superpower, the United States, and by Britain. They basically, as we know from the case of David Miller, are in the business of silencing people they don't agree with. And quite literally in the Palestinian case, where lots and lots of peaceful demonstrators have simply been shot dead by snipers in very recent history.
Yeah, just before we finish the first part, what about the steel industry, Martin? Because we've seen this week that the whole thing seems to be collapsing like a house of cards, and the government is quite happy to watch as the steel industry goes down the tubes in the run-up to a war, possibly.
Well, the steel industry obviously has been hit by this collapse of this Australian loan firm, Greensill. And of course, it's not owned by the British government anymore. It's owned by the Indian entrepreneur whose name I've forgotten, who's basically promised to try and keep it going. I think you saw what happened with the Deliveroo share issue that collapsed. We've had a collapse of a hedge fund in the US, which is causing reverberations. I think we're quite likely going to see a crash in the not too distant future. The markets are all over the place, the highest they've ever been. And this kind of speculative frenzy is going to meet what's technically called a Minsky moment. And then, of course, the bankruptcies are going to flow through the system.
But, I mean, do you think if we had a Corbyn government, they would have bailed them out and nationalised the steel again?
Well, if we'd had a Corbyn government, they wouldn't. If they go bust, then you could nationalise them without spending any money on them. If they're bankrupt, you take them over. But the question is, what are you going to do? Where are you going to sell the steel? Now, the obvious thing to do is to coordinate with the Chinese and others to try and reflate the global economy. But that's not what's happening. We're actually shaping up for a pre-World War One punch-up, which, of course, when World War One broke out, the stock markets around the world just collapsed. And that's probably what's going to happen.
One of the things Keir Starmer pointed out at the last Prime Minister's questions was that Boris was absolutely guaranteeing in the general election to make sure that the army was kept up at full strength, blah, blah. Now he's just lopped off 10,000 soldiers in the defence review to about 12% drop in the number.
Yeah. And of course, what they're doing is they're expanding our nuclear arsenal. I mean, I don't see what the point is. I mean, if you can destroy the world 20 times over, why spend more money to be able to destroy it 25 times over?
Well, they're putting it into things like cyber warfare, psychological warfare, because they can't win a actual fighting war, I guess.
I think that the what they're doing is they are being poodles to the United States as always. And that's why our aircraft carrier is busily steaming into the South China Sea as we speak in order to poke the Chinese in the eye. At the same time, of course, we've got nurses who are not being paid a decent wage.
And in Northern Ireland, talks of a unification referendum.
Well, I mean, that's been hanging around for quite a long time. I think the Sinn Féin have constantly called for it. I mean, they generally do call for it. But I don't think it's going to happen until there's a clear majority. There's a majority moving towards wanting a referendum, but some of those people are on the loyalist side and they want a referendum, because if you have a referendum and the nationalists don't win, then that will put it to bed for another period of time. So I think from a Republican strategy point of view, I would suggest that you don't really want to go for that referendum until you're pretty certain that you're going to win it.
And finally, Britain's slide into authoritarianism, says the London Economic. How the Tories have built a one-party state. And it doesn't say much for the Labour Party, does it? I mean, it does. There's quite a lot of people pointed out, as we've had Tom doing, that the Labour Party seems to prefer to abstain from legislation and just allow the Tories to push it through without any challenge at all.
Well, they were going to abstain on the Police and Powers Bill. But because of what happened at Clapham, they decided they turned on a sixpence and decided to vote against it. And of course, the extension of powers which would allow police, military, and intelligence services to break the law, all the opposition parties voted against, including Plaid Cymru, SNP, Greens, Liberal Democrats. The Labour Party abstained. The reason why they're doing this is because they want to win swing constituencies which voted Tory this time, which were traditionally Labour constituencies and were pro.
Well, in the next general election, in what is it, 4 years' time?
In the next general election, that's what they're trying to do. But of course, we're going to have the Hartlepool by-election on May the 6th. And I think it's fairly clear that the Tories are going to win that. So Keir Starmer's strategy of trying to appeal to right-wing, culturally Brexit, pro-Brexit voters is just doomed.
Is it? I mean, isn't Peter Mandelson just pulling his strings? He's just a, you know, basically...
Well, Peter Mandelson used to be the MP for Hartlepool, and it was a solid Labour constituency.
But what I'm saying, Martin, is Peter, if Peter Mandelson is pulling Keir Starmer's strings, and you know, the right wing of the Labour Party, they've always been anti Corbyn and the rest of them. In fact, you know, basically like infiltrators into their own party, trying to just stop it winning elections and this sort of thing. We've got, you know, hard evidence of all that stuff. You know, surely it is a one party state we're in, and actually, a lot of people are saying the only opposition in the country is come from within the Tory Party itself.
Well, the problem is, underlying all of this, as I stress week after week, is that the British political system is a knackered old nag from the 18th century. It's designed to give Eton College a permanent veto on what happens in the country.
Look, you can't just use that to wriggle out of the fact that the Labour Party should be surely opposing. Why aren't they?
I want the Labour Party to oppose those things. I'm just telling you what Starmer's thinking is. It's pretty lame thinking, in my view, and it's got no hope of success. And I think what may well happen after May the 6th is, if Starmer doesn't get more votes than Corbyn got last time, then people are going to be asking questions, what's the point of Keir Starmer?
I said, certainly that's one of the questions I ask myself almost daily. But anyway, so we're going to have a bit of music now, and we'll be back after our little break. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. You can join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
Oh,
So that's the St. Edmundsbury Cathedral Choir singing for All the Saints, and Blue Oyster Cult from 1972 with Screams from their debut, pretty amazing little debut album. So into the international hour, or the international side part of part two of the politics show. We'll be looking at Eric Prince from Blackwater. Great little article Martin emailed me this week. He's the one, this is the, not the one in Surrey, next to the Royal Military College at Sandhurst. No, the private military company contracted by the Pentagon and NATO intelligence services. Wherever there's peace, they see terror, particularly Islamist terror, like a drone. However evil the task, if proper soldiers won't do it, Eric Prince will. Martin takes a look at this Machiavellian war criminal who's one of the wealthiest people in the world of the private armies. And also, a year after the so-called emergency COVID legislation, renewed from arguably the best placed critic of these policies, who's deplatformed by YouTube, Twitter and the rest, is the former Pfizer vice president of respiratory diseases, Dr. Mike Yeadon. If you're under 60 and healthy or have had COVID, don't have a jab, he says. This week is take on who should and who should not have a vaccine. And also, as Natalie was saying last week, Natalie Minnis, that is, apocalypse means secrets being uncovered. Well, here's one, how to start a war. An examination of how the First World War started and why it didn't finish in 1916 when it all conked out. It started up for another 2 years, round of human slaughter all over again. The book is The Hidden History of the First World War by Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor. Also, Understanding 9/11, The Key to Stopping World War III, Webster Tarpley's 2005 lecture in New York City is one of the most outstanding explanations of what really happened that day, just over 3 years after the attacks on New York and Washington. Webster gave that. That was removed by toxic Google for so-called hate speech, but it popped back up, and we're going to have a little listen to that again tonight. And also, the resources to be grabbed in war. You know, this is one of the things that people talk about, isn't it? Why would anyone want to start a war? Of course they wouldn't, but there's some people that make an absolute fortune out of it. Maybe even Mr. Gates taking over the world food supply. And finally, the depopulation agenda tonight. This is a clip from the one of the very last Cutting Through the Matrix done by Alan Watt. How to dispose of all of us useless eaters deprived of a livelihood while the Amazons, the Teslas and Facebook's share value goes through the roof. Alan died suddenly last month, age 55. So, but anyway, Martin, let's start with Joe Biden and his press conference. It's, you know, it's amazing, really, that it's taken so long for him to actually do a press conference a couple of months after he not only was elected, but a couple of months after he actually took office. And it was a bit of a disaster, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've read reports of it that suggested that he really wasn't in control of the situation, didn't know what was going on, and clearly, you know, whoever's running the United States of America, it ain't Joe Biden.
No, well, can you just take us through how he got there? Because, you know, he isn't necessarily, I mean, if you look at the guy in the press conference, he clearly isn't all there. He's not surely the best candidate the Democratic Party can find for all those members. He's just been, you know, selected by a particular group within that party as a kind of puppet, surely.
Well, I think the real problem here is that the Bernie Sanders was doing quite well and in the primaries, but the primaries were stitched up against him last time and they were pretty much stitched up against him this time. And the you know, Wall Street and the Pentagon, they basically vet who can and can't be president of the United States. And I think Bernie Sanders' campaign for the Democratic nomination came unglued in South Carolina, which has a fairly large Democratic population, Democratic voters who are black, and they, for whatever reason, and the establishment of the party decided that they were going to go for somebody who was basically an old retread, which is what Joe Biden is. And I think he won the election. I think he did win the election. I think the Trump people saying that he didn't are missing the point. Trump, although he mobilized a lot of people who liked him, lots of other people were determined that he wasn't going to be the president. And they voted Biden just to keep Trump out.
Well, one of the reasons
they had much delusions about what Biden was going to be like when they got when he got there.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that Biden was elected, surely, was to do with the George Floyd incident. And Derek Chauvin is on trial now. I mean, personally, I find it rather despicable to be being spoon-fed all the gory details again and again and again. All I want to know is Derek Chauvin going to go down for life or not? I'm interested in the verdict, but not all that we know the details. We've seen it all.
Well, I mean, I haven't been following it on TV, but one of my friends has. And in actual fact, there's quite a lot of detail, which is damning, really, of Chauvin's actions. And his own police chief, I understand, is going to testify against him. And what becomes clear is that Floyd was no threat to the police whatsoever. He was basically totally compliant from the get-go. He never made any attempt to run away. He never made any attempt to assault them. And, you know, they didn't need to do what they did. And therefore, it's quite likely there's going to be a guilty verdict.
I mean, interesting, it was being filmed from all different directions.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of different film of it all.
Yeah. Would you say that's suspicious? You think this was maybe an incident which was
When it first happened, I was wondering, is this a confected incident? But you've got to remember that two things. It wasn't just one person. There was a woman who was a fire officer who was present and said, "You mustn't do that to him. I'm a first responder. I'm a firefighter. You can't do that to him." And they were just told to go away. So that all sorts of passers-by were intervening to say, you know, get off his neck. And he just took no notice. But, of course, what made people angry was that this isn't just an isolated incident. The United States police force kills 1,000 people every year. Every year without fail, 1,000 people die at their hands. And many of them are predominantly poor. Many of them are black.
What do you make of the
people in Martin, the inner cities in the United States?
Yeah, right. Martin, well, what do you make of the report this week that says that Britain is not institutionally racist, that actually this is much more to do with economics, with poverty being the victims of various sorts of discrimination, people who are poor, white and black?
Well, let's think. What was this report? Because of the Black Lives Matter protests last year, the government felt that it had to come up with a report into what was going on vis-a-vis racial discrimination in Britain. And surprise, surprise, their hand-picked crew decided... I was really worried about this, that Britain was racist, but now the Tory government have brought forward a report from their hand-picked crew, and apparently we're not racist at all, so there's nothing to see here, folks. Move along. It's an insult, really, because we all know that there's plenty of things need to be done to deal with problems of racism in this country.
Well, and okay, but
the
it's
report
not,
I mean, is basically a whitewash, quite literally.
Well, that's what they've said, but I mean, there's also spurned by this. Tyson Fury has attended something called a Travellers' Lives Matter protest in Morecambe. I think surely. You know, there is an element of this, which is many, particularly in the United States, more so than here, that the vast areas of the poor, ghettos, etc., are black. And it's actually much more to do in many ways with people's attempting to survive in a horrific economic environment, particularly with all this COVID stuff now depriving many people of their livelihoods, either on benefits or etc., a kind of underclass, which is both white and black, Martin. You can't deny that.
Well, I don't deny that. the idea that the only discrimination and problems that we face are to do with skin colour would be absurd. The fundamental problems are indeed to do with economics and to do with poverty.
I mean, you and I have discussed
overwhelmingly.
You and I have discussed on here before the funding for the Black Lives Matter campaign in the United States was coming from George Soros's Open Society Foundation, and also from a woman who was the granddaughter of one of the big oil magnates that started funding the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, so, you know, you just start to look a little bit orchestrated as a kind of divide and rule strategy. I'm not saying, obviously, that black people aren't discriminated against. Of course they are. But the idea here seems to be to get whites and blacks at each other's throats while the rich black and white fold their arms and look on and laugh.
Well, the Black Lives Matter, like all social movements, is got various elements within it. And one of the things that happened was lots of corporate organizations, you know, wanting to be seen to be doing something and showing that they accepted the arguments of Black Lives Matter, etc. But this is an old game. It's a game of co-optation. And what's I found absolutely extraordinary about all the protests in the United States is that they have that was instituted some years ago, a Martin Luther King holiday. So they have a day off work to remember Martin Luther King. But at the same time, a court in Tennessee, a civil court with a jury, concluded some years ago that Martin Luther King was undoubtedly assassinated by the FBI, that is to say, by the government. But nobody has ever been punished. Now, in a society like the United States, where somebody like Martin Luther King, if you can imagine, he could have been the president. He could have been Obama. But he can't be anything because he's dead and he was killed by the government and nobody's been punished for it.
Well, you know what? You remind me.
That is a racist society by any definition.
Well, you're reminding me, Martin, of the whole situation with Princess Diana at her inquest. That was decided as an unlawful killing, certainly not an accident. And yet nothing seems to have happened there. Princess Diana was campaigning generally pro-Palestinian. I mean, you know, she was doing a lot of campaigning for Palestinians. She was also campaigning against landmines. Goodness knows what position she would be in now. And the reason for targeting her seems to be simply, as maybe the same with Martin Luther King, that these people were able to attract massive crowds, massive press attention, and actually get something positive done.
Well, I mean, and don't forget that these famous people that we've mentioned obviously were assassinated, but lots of other people are assassinated all the time. It's normal business in Western so-called democracies.
It's incredible, isn't it,
to be assassinated?
Yeah, that people are so high profile and that people can think they can get away with it. I find that almost more incredible. And we'll be hearing
the president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, was assassinated by the government. That's how powerful that deep state is, isn't it?
It certainly was, yeah. And anyone that's looked into that will enjoy listening to the two-hour-long interview, which you can find on Radio 4 All, with James Files, who was the assassin. And he was from the Chicago Mafia. He was one of their hitmen. He was brought down. He was behind the picket fence on the Glassy Knoll. This is all known stuff, but the mass media don't want to share it with the public. In fact, Wim Dankbar, who did that recording, who got that recording, did the book, I think it's called Files on JFK. Every time I speak to him, he says, oh, yes, I'm being promised a great deal, and it's going to be out in the public in the next few months. And, of course, it never is. Very much like chatting with Lawrence DeMello about the Martin Bormann story. Every time I speak to her, it's like it's about to be, you know, break across the world, and it never does, because this stuff is such important hidden history that even there are even forces today, when everyone's dead and gone, that want to keep it quiet. But anyway, look, we started by talking about Joe Biden. Let's have a listen to this minute-long extract from his press conference, which it's in a way it's a bit unfair because he did a little bit better in other parts of the press conference, but this is the bit of his first ever press conference that he'll be remembered for, I'm afraid.
So the best way to get something done, if it holds near and dear to you that you like to be able to, anyway, we're going to get a lot done. And if we have to, if there's complete lockdown and chaos as a consequence of the filibuster, then we'll have to go beyond what I'm talking about. Okay, hang on. Sorry. Oh, Sing Ming, Ms. Kim.
Thank you, Mr. President. To follow up on the filibuster, so do you believe it should take 60 votes to end a filibuster on legislation or 51?
If we could end it with 51, we would have no problem. You're going to have to, the existing rule, it's going to be hard to get a parliamentary ruling that allows 50 votes to end the filibuster.
Well, what he's doing there, Martin, is he's forgetting what he's talking about in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah.
It's quite sad to watch, really.
It is, but don't forget that Ronald Reagan was pretty much not all there. And George Bush didn't know what was going on either, even though he got quite a big mouth. The President of the United States, as the Russians well know, doesn't actually decide anything much. There are people around Biden who are basically running the show. And they, you know, like Blinken and others, the neocons that have all infested this new administration as they've infested previous administrations.
Well, one of the biggies that they're talking about in the States at the moment, hopefully not here, but certainly over there, and our countries do tend to work in parallel, I'm afraid, was the Steve Hilton show on Fox News, which has become virtually unmissable. I mean, it's certainly if I was in the US and I could pick it up on terrestrial TV or whatever, I'd be watching that every week, glued to it, really. And it's wonderful to see that it's actually a Murdoch program that is worth watching. Of course, Murdoch is responsible for the owner of Talk Radio here in the UK, which was pulled off of YouTube recently when Boris made his announcement of the second lockdown, the Halloween lockdown. Then there was so many comments on there by not by their presenters, but by people phoning in and criticising that it had to be taken off of YouTube for a short period of time, at which point Rupert Murdoch's lawyers got their teeth into Google and YouTube and it came back up again. If only the rest of us could do that sort of legal help. But anyway, here is Steve Hilton from last Saturday. That's the 28th of March on Fox News. His program is called The Next Revolution. And he's actually a former advisor to David Cameron. Goodness me. He seems to be enjoying his role as about the only place in the Western world where some of the really hard truths about things can be discussed. And the here he has Naomi Wolf on here, who's a US-based writer, talking about these vaccine passports, which they're thinking about introducing in the United States and possibly in Britain too. But let's have a listen now to Steve Hilton from last Sunday evening with Naomi Wolf.
The Biden administration said they're working towards developing a new nationwide vaccine passport standard. On and on it goes. A nightmare, Orwellian infrastructure of control, an unprecedented, undemocratic power grab by big business, big government, big bureaucracy. No, no, no. Here to react, author of The End of America, a letter of warning to a young patriot, Dr. Naomi Wolf. So excited that you could join us tonight. I'm just going to hand it over to you. What do you make of what we're about to see?
Thank you, Steve. I'm really happy to be here. I am not overstating this. I can't say it forcefully enough. This is literally the end of human liberty in the West if this plan unfolds as planned. Vaccine passport sounds like a fine thing if you don't understand what those platforms can do. I'm CEO of a tech company. I understand what this platform does. It's not about the vaccine. It's not about the virus. It's about your data. And once this rolls out, you don't have a choice about being part of the system. What people have to understand is that any other functionality can be loaded onto that platform with no problem at all. And what that means is it can be merged with your PayPal account, with your digital currency. Microsoft is already talking about merging it with payment plans. Your networks can be sucked up. It geolocates you everywhere you go. Your credit history can be included. All of your medical history can be included. This has already happened in Israel. Yeah. And 6 months months later, we're hearing from activists that it's a two-tier society and that basically activists are ostracized and surveilled continually. It's the end of civil society, and they're trying to roll it out around the world. And it is absolutely so much more than a vaccine pass. I cannot stress enough that it has the power to turn off your life or to turn on your life, to let you engage in society or be marginalized. And by the way, the last thing I'll say, IBM has a horrible history with Nazi Germany. Its subsidiary created a kind of precursor of this with punch cards that allowed the Nazis to keep lists of, again, a two-tiered society, Aryan and Jew, in such a way that they could round up Jews, round up dissidents, round up opposition leaders very, very quickly. It's catastrophic. It cannot be allowed to continue.
And the other thing it reminds me of course, is the Chinese regime today and the social credit system that they're using for exactly the kind of purposes that you're describing. Let's talk about how to fight this. I mean, we're completely in agreement about how appalling this is. What do you think we can do?
Well, you're exactly right, Steve, to mention China. I mean, how do you keep a billion people under the thumb of a totalitarian regime? The CCP can find any dissident within 5 minutes, and that can happen here literally within months. How do we fight it? Well, that's a longer conversation, but I've launched on my own platform a kind of freedom movement for left and right to come together to run people for state senate, to run people against tyrannical governors like Gavin Newsom, my own governor Cuomo, who's rolling out this tyrannical pass, you know, under emergency powers, and to really unite to take back our constitution. But we have to bring lawsuits, and there have to be investigations. I mean, this violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. It violates HIPAA. It violates the First Amendment. It violates the Fourth Amendment. And we have to call up an army of lawyers and fund them to, you know, bring every lawsuit, but also just refuse to comply.
The Biden administration is moving forward with this, so we've got to fight it. Dr. Naomi,
thank you so much.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much.
So that's Steve Hilton and Naomi Wolf there from The Next Revolution on Fox News last Sunday, the 28th of March. I never thought I'd say it, Martin. Rupert Murdoch, the last bastion of free speech and common sense on in the Western world's mass media.
Well, I think the stuff that he was doing previously about the source of the virus in Wuhan was more to my taste and more investigative. This is essentially, I mean, the question of how much power governments should have, digital corporations should have.
Well, you just don't like it because he's criticising China.
No, it's not about China. We're not talking now about the source of the virus. The Steve Hilton show that we've had excerpts from in previous weeks has been very interesting about the source of the virus, because that's genuine investigative reporting. Now, this is a bit different. This is taking a strong line about what the Biden administration wants to do with vaccines and passports and so on.
It's not just there, is it? It's in the UK too, funnily enough.
There's going to be a major issue with this.
We just had, in fact, I think it's even today, I heard Silky Carlo from Big Brother Watch on the 10 o'clock Radio 4 News Bulletin talking about the COVID passports for Britain. And there's been a group of MPs protesting against it. Actually doing something about it. Baroness Chakrabarty from ex-Liberty warned the passports risk creating a checkpoint Britain, as more than 70 MPs railed against their use in Britain. Jeremy Corbyn and senior Tory Ian Duncan-Smith amongst a broad coalition who pledged their opposition. I never thought I'd say Corbyn and Duncan Smith in the same sentence, Martin. But what she's saying is similar to what's happening here, it seems, a coalition of left and right against these things.
Yeah, and I think there are very definitely very serious issues involved with something like this. But you've got to recognise that whatever we decide or not to don't decide to do in Britain, other countries are going to take their own steps. So, for example, it may well be that if you want to visit a country, they're going to say, we want evidence of vaccination or you can't come.
But, I mean, they're going to be thinking twice. This is a bit of a flaw in Bill Gates's big master plan, isn't it? That say if a country says we don't require vaccine passports, they're going to get all the tourists.
Well, that may be so, but it may also be the case that the country that says, you know, New Zealand have made their position clear. until they've got herd immunity, which means vaccination with their whole population, nobody from the outside is going to come in. And they're going to carry on with quarantine and all the rest
of it. Have you seen these draconian measures they've taken now in France? I mean, funnily enough, the place where the most organised protest against civil society protest against a tyrannical government in the yellow vests was getting its act together. It was actually making some real differences in France. And funnily enough, now they're having all these new measures brought in where you have to fill out a form before you're allowed to step out your front door.
Well, it sounds similar to what's actually happened in some countries is they've lost control of the situation. It's a very, very dangerous situation for them to be in.
Well, you can't control a situation with a virus. It either burns out. It's like flu. You know, you can't say you're going to control flu, Martin, can you?
We've had this debate week in, week out. There are various countries in Southeast Asia which are COVID-free. They don't even have to vaccinate.
Yeah, so you think we should stop COVID? What's the point of all these vaccinations if there's no COVID around at all?
Well, what's the point of the vaccinations? The real problem with the vaccinations is that if as the virus carries on mutating in the developing world, which is not part of the sort of Southeast Asian bloc, Brazil, for example, new variations are going to develop. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not been used in South Africa, for example, because it doesn't work against that variant. And so what could well happen, I've already had my first AstraZeneca jab, it's quite possible that it won't work against other variants that are going to come, that are going to develop. So that the whole vaccination program may be just a waste of time, and that you can't actually stop COVID other than by doing the things that the New Zealanders and the Chinese did, test and trace, isolate.
Okay, so they've got a nationwide, you reckon it's okay, a year after this virus, to have a nationwide curfew of 7 p.m. right across France? Surely this is a political measure to stop dissent and to destroy civil liberties. This has nothing to do with the virus.
The French have lost control, Tony. Macron is actually an incompetent, unlike the people running China or New Zealand.
Has he lost control of the country in terms of...
He's lost control of the viral transmission of the virus. And the EU have not exactly filled themselves with glory in organising the vaccination of their people.
No, it all seems to be being very politicised, doesn't it? Anyway, look, on the thoughts of whether or not we need a vaccine, this is, my special... interview for Good Friday, which is about whether we need a vaccine or not, because there hasn't been a proper discussion about this at all. Everyone is just told, oh, you've got to have a vaccine, it's going to come to you eventually, hang on and wait. Of course, there are all sorts of reasons why you might not need a vaccine. One is that you actually have a negative reaction to vaccines, or you've had them in the past, a very basic thing which is never discussed at all. They also talk about, you know, whole populations being vaccinated when, of course, they haven't been, like Gibraltar. It's just that people have been offered a vaccine. Everyone has been offered it. It's not the same as everybody taking it. So there's a very, very hard sell. It's as if the mass media TV news bulletins are all being, apart from Steve Hilton's, it seems, being written by the big pharma, saying, look, here's the great thing. They have loads of pictures, don't they, of people who have just had their vaccine. They're overjoyed. This is using the news media for propaganda. And so in order to sort of puncture that a bit, I thought we'd have a clip from Dr. Mike Yeadon, who we had an exclusive with last week, with Kevin Carhill commenting on that. It'd be interesting to see what you've got to say to this, Martin, because he doesn't believe everybody needs the vaccine at all. I asked him about what he thinks, who should and who should not get themselves vaccinated.
So I would say healthy people under 60, so a lot of us, they're at such low risk from this virus. If you didn't seek a flu vaccine, don't get a COVID vaccine, because if you're under 60 and in good health, you're at greater risk from flu than COVID. That's published information by one of the world's top epidemiologists, Dr. John Ioannidis. So if you're under 60 in good health, don't get the COVID vaccine. Also, I don't believe for a moment if you accept this vaccine, it will hasten the return of freedoms. So if you're doing it for that reason, a non-medical reason, I'm sorry, just look at the number of times the government has moved the goalposts. Look into the eyes of Matthew Hancock. Do you believe what he says? And I don't. And so if you were thinking of getting it so you could go on holiday or go to the park, what an absurd reason for taking an experimental gene-based vaccine against a disease that you are not at risk from. When I say it like that, you must realize it's just crackers and that these people have reasons other than your health that's inspiring them to try and persuade you. Now, I don't know what they are exactly, but they are not good for you. So if you're healthy and under 60, don't do it. You won't get your freedoms back. And I would say that there are some countries that have already said we don't need vaccine certificates. I don't know which countries they are. They change from day to day. But I would say feed that hand. You know, if those people want to take you in without vaccine passport, do that. I do think certainly younger people like my children in their 20s, they are not at measurable risk from this virus at all. Not at all. And therefore, even if you had years of experience with these vaccines, it would just be just like bad economics. But this way, it's bad risk benefit because you don't quite know what the safety is. But the safety is not complete. Every medical intervention, whether a tablet, injection, they always come with some measure of risk. So if you're 25 and in perfect health, you're not at measurable risk. You simply can't find anyone of that description who's died. You had to be seriously ill beforehand. So why in the world would you take an experimental medical treatment that's almost 2 years from completing its clinical trials? This wasn't an alleged emergency. This material would be 2 years away from even contemplating giving it to you. And then, as I said to you earlier, Tony, why are the medical professionals silent? What I've just described, they would never have done this 3 years ago. It wouldn't take an experimental medicine and give it to people who are not at risk from the virus it's meant to immunize you against. They would say this is a stupid thing to do. So why are they not saying that?
And what about people who've actually had COVID?
That's just stupid then. You know, everybody, definitely, this is a field I know a lot about. If you have recovered from this respiratory virus, because I've looked at pretty much all the good quality published literature, you are now immune. And the reason you are is the fact you're still alive. This virus will multiply pretty well in your body. So if you've caught it, it starts to multiply. Most people who are not ill or very old, you will mount an immune response to it. And within days to a couple of weeks at most, you will have overwhelmed it 99.9% of the time. And it leaves you with both antibodies and what are called T cells, which remember the encounter and will protect you against it if you see it again or one of its close brothers. So I personally think it's actually slightly dangerous to get vaccinated if you've had COVID. I've heard of, and we haven't yet seen the results, but we've heard of antibody-dependent enhancement. I'm not claiming that is definitely a big risk, but some people believe it's a very big risk. And what it says is if you've had the disease before and you've already got your body primed against it, the fear is that if you have a vaccine, that might actually bring about a worse outcome for you than if you were completely naive. So I think since you don't need it, you don't need to be protected by vaccine if you've survived already, your immunity has coped with it, and there is this theoretical risk of antibody-dependent enhancement. And as I've said previously, it's an experimental medicine. Maybe you'll be unlucky and get a blood clot and die. Mm. So if you've had COVID, don't get vaccinated.
Well, on the blood clots thing, I've noticed that they said only five people in the UK have got blood clots from the AstraZeneca. And then after some Freedom of Information request, it's gone up to 30 that people have got this. I mean, we could probably agree, Martin, couldn't we, that when you look into Matt Hancock's eyes, it doesn't look like he's telling the truth.
No, and I think that the government have bet the farm on vaccination as the way to end the crisis, and it may well be either that the vaccines don't work, as I said earlier, or that they're potentially dangerous. And I take the point that if you've had COVID, what we should be able to do is test people to see if they've got antibodies. Now, then some people will not, I would argue, as has just been argued by the contributor, that people who've had COVID and have got antibodies, there's no point vaccinating them. It's a waste of vaccine. And we need to have a rational discussion about this.
Well, yeah, but that is, I mean, one of the things that Mike Yeadon says there, which I think maybe you can help answer this. He says, All I can tell you as a doctor, as someone that spent his life working in that industry, is that the decisions that they're making are not about health. So, but I know he doesn't really understand. Can you help us there? What are they about?
Well, one of the things that's going on is there's a massive struggle over who's going to make the profits out of this pandemic. And the AstraZeneca vaccine has been stopped for use in various countries, and not least the United States, because Pfizer and Moderna, who are absolutely 100% for-profit companies, they want to dominate the vaccine market. And they've also, the US have been putting pressure on the Brazilians not to allow the Sputnik vaccine to come to Brazil. So underlying all of this is a kind of fight for who's going to get to make vaccines.
Well, I don't know if you've seen it, Martin, but the Austrian government has upset Brussels by saying they are going to have, whether Brussels likes it or not, the Russian Sputnik V vaccine.
Well, the thing about the Russians and the Sinopharm, the Chinese vaccine, is that they are basically, because they're, you know, essentially socialized set up, they are basically using vaccine, you know, providing vaccines for developing countries as a way of building an image for themselves as helpful and constructive. I mean, what you would have thought would have happened in a situation like this, and it was pushed for by South Africa and by India, that there should be no patents on the vaccines to deal with coronavirus. Everybody should pool all of their resources. Everybody should work together, and we should try, you know, vaccinating as
well,
many
people as we can. Well, I bet you they didn't go for that one.
Sorry?
I said, I bet you they didn't go for that one, because that's the whole
thing. No, they didn't. I mean, the Western Pharmaceutical Company said, oh, no, no. And, of course, Boris famously said to the 1922 committee that it was greed and capitalism that had allowed Britain to get ahead in the vaccine race.
Mm.
And, of course, what this really means is that COVID swirls around in places like Brazil, where it's clearly out of control. It's carrying on mutating. And therefore, potentially, you're going to develop variants which won't, but the vaccines that we've already got won't be able to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's, so, I get the impression,
you know, that that's where we are.
Like Matt Hancock are struggling with something they don't really understand, which Mike Yeadon does say that in the longer version of that interview, which I'll put up again, as I did last week, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the full version of that, because it's a fascinating journey through someone who's worked for Pfizer in that field, who is one of the most critical people. One of the things he says, Martin, is that he's spoken to countless scientists, but the thing is that they don't want to speak out because it could threaten their funding at universities, which is universally pretty much funded by the pharmaceutical industry itself.
Yeah, I think what this whole crisis has brought into absolutely excruciating perspective is the massive power of the Western pharmaceutical industry. And of course, they pushed for years to patent they use patenting of drugs as a mechanism for extracting super profits from the world's population and from people's misery. We need a socialized system of medicine production for every medicine, so that medicine, I mean, if you look at what's happening around the world, if poor countries are unable to deal with this pandemic, then they are going to they're steaming towards a massive economic and social crisis. And of course, nobody is safe till everybody's safe. And that's goes not just for dealing with COVID, but in lots of other problems which are totally interrelated.
The thing is, Martin, pretty much everybody under 60 is already safe. So when we want,
I'm not going to argue with a doctor saying that, but we do know, for example, that some people younger than 60 have died from it.
Other conditions. Is what he's saying. If you're healthy and you're under 60, you don't need the jab.
Well, anyway, I certainly take the point that if you've had COVID and you've got antibodies, you don't need to take the jab. No problem with that.
Okay, anyway, so we've also this week, because all of this is relying on testing, and I hate to say it, but this is an absolute dog's breakfast, which has been privatised. And one of the main labs in the country that's doing these tests is in Milton Keynes. The BBC were a rare occasion where they actually did some ballsy undercover filming in there. This is a panorama from the beginning of the week here. Secret filming at one of the biggest UK COVID testing labs found evidence of contamination, discarded tests, and pressure to hit targets. Great. Evidence at the lab captured on film shows checks to ensure samples could be identified were rushed. Tests were discarded unnecessarily as a result. Some test samples glooped. That is, so that it wasn't. It was supposed to be a liquid, but it wasn't. It was kind of gloopy. And it went across an area where other samples were placed, meaning contamination of other samples by those. Swabs used by people to take COVID tests left in their tubes, presenting further risks of contamination. Quality control scientists telling the reporter the quality of the results progressively got worse as the day progressed. Now, for those people that have got a positive test from this lab, they must now be wondering, well, that's probably a load, well, it could easily be a load of nonsense.
And also, of course, they may be missing people that they should be catching. It's, you know, that we all know what a disaster this has been. Billions, tens of billions of pounds put in the hands of Serco and nothing really to show for it. And of course, the real problem is that once you've even got a positive test, they don't then trace people who've been in contact with them. They don't. There's no proper self-isolation. We had some Tory council leaders the other day saying that people shouldn't be given money to self-isolate because it would encourage them to get COVID. And you compare that with the disciplined and effective strategies that have been pursued in Southeast Asia for a fraction of the cost, and you realise what an absolute shower the people running this country are. They're shysters and incompetent shysters at that.
So the lab can process 70,000 coronavirus tests per day, but while the BBC reporter was there, it was usually down around 30,000. So some of the people were just sitting around with nothing to do. Technicians worked to targets regardless of the number of people arriving in a 24-hour period. At the sorting stage, where tubes containing people's COVID test samples were removed from bags, checks to ensure they were traceable were just rushed. That's at the very start of the testing process, so the person could be mixed up with another one, for example. Anyway, it just sounds to me like this is a completely disastrous place that needs to be properly run, probably by the NHS and in the public sector, Martin.
Well, yes, I think that's the obvious point, isn't it? The vaccine rollout, which has been regarded as a general success in the mainstream, has basically not been anything to do with capitalism or greed. Oxford University scientists developed it, and they wanted to just put it out as an open patent. But the government decided to bring AstraZeneca in to make it because they haven't got the facilities to make stuff. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians have got facilities to make stuff. They don't just design the vaccines. They then put their state-run factories to produce the vaccines. And of course, in China, they haven't really vaccinated most of their own population. They're going out into the developing world to, you know, give what they regard as solidarity to their allies. We will vaccinate, but of course they're not necessarily going to rush to do it in China. They've got COVID under control without vaccination.
Anyway, I can't stress enough for listeners, if you'd like to kind of go to find it on, I put it on BitChute and also up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's completely pointless. Amazing interview though it is, uploading this sort of thing to YouTube, because it's immediately taken down, or what they call medical misinformation. So anything that is, for example, questioning lockdowns, for example, that will get your YouTube video taken down, as Mike does in the clip we heard last week. So that's a full clip, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page. I think it's called something like a year into the lockdown lunacy, exclusive with Mike Yeadon. But anyway, Martin, we're going to go on and look at some other stuff now, and that is really to do with the Rockefeller medical monopoly. I thought we'd have a listen to this little clip. It's only about 3 minutes, but it's looking at the background to that pharmaceutical industry. You were just saying there, and quite rightly so, that this whole business with COVID, one of the main things it's done for us is it's made us realise that we've got this monster on our doorstep that's actually grabbing our children and injecting them with things that they don't need to have for profit. Really, this is one of the most disgusting forms of child abuse, I think, that we've ever encountered on planet Earth. And it's being done systematically by lily-livered governments who've got absolutely no guts to stand up to these people who are just doing this for money. So let's have a listen now to Euston Mullins talking about the 1900s advance of what he calls the Rockefeller medical monopoly.
Well, I had been working for almost a half a century on the various monopolies, the legal monopoly, the banking monopoly, the secret government monopoly of the world, and I realized that all of these monopolies interacted, and about the same group of elitists, the world order people, were in each one. But I had not paid much attention to the medical profession. I thought, well, these are doctors who are curing people. They work in the hospital long hours, you know, and they're probably a public asset. During this period, as part of the drug trust and the medical monopoly, had various instruments furnished to them by the other monopolies. For instance, the oil monopoly of John D. Rockefeller at Standard Oil had gone into the petrochemical business, and through extensive research, they had developed certain medications, which they called wonder drugs, and the public, as they took these drugs, they would wonder what was going to happen to them. That's why they were wonder drugs. Others were called miracle drugs. They were called miracle drugs because if you took them and you survived, it was really a miracle. So this was the contribution of the monopolists to the medical monopoly. And the only thing that these drugs had in common was that they were enormously expensive. Now, in contrast, most of nature's remedies are enormously inexpensive. They're available, they're abundant, they're cheap, which means that the medical monopoly did not want you to use any of these medications. They wanted the greatest achievement of the modern drug trust was the invention of the $1,000 pill. They have now they have one pill which costs $1,000, which you use in cancer and various things. And nature, unfortunately, has never learned how to make a $1,000 pill. So obviously, nature is no good as far as the medical monopoly is concerned. So by taking over the medical industry in 1910, through studies which he made through the Carnegie Foundation, John D. Rockefeller emerged as the kingpin of the medical monopoly in the United States. And he now presided over an allopathic system of medicine controlled through every legislature by accreditation of hospitals, control of physicians, control of medications, and which is essentially what we have today. So from 1910, when this change was effected, right to the present day, the cost of health care has multiplied astronomically in the United States to the point where it is no longer available to most American citizens. So how did they counteract this? When they got us to the point where the average working man could not afford hospital care or the allopathic system of treatment, they set up an insurance industry, medical insurance. And through this, they were able to spread out the costs among everybody. And health insurance today is simply another tax on the American people. In fact, it functions through the Social Security system as a tax on the recipients of Social Security. They say, well, now that you've reached your senior citizen stank, you have Social Security coming in, so then they jerk back a good portion of it as Medicare costs, which they raise every year.
So that's Eustace Mullins there talking about the Rockefeller monopoly. But I mean, I think he's, in a way, it's quite sweet to hear him there saying, well, I was looking at all these other monopolies, like the oil monopolies and this kind of thing, that probably looking at banking cartels and goodness knows what. But he never really noticed these. He thought, well, these people are doctors. They surely all they can do is be helping us. But of course, there's managers and account managers and other people behind the scenes who are turning this into a massive money making bonanza.
Yes. And as we know, as he pointed out, perhaps a majority of US citizens haven't got any health insurance effectively. And it's a rubbish way to, I mean, you know, their so-called public health system is a shambles. You can compare that to much poorer countries like Kerala in southern India, which has concentrated for many years on what you might call basic healthcare. Yeah, so they know they've got very limited resources, so they make sure they've got things like clean water, land reform, healthy diets, all sorts of stuff to make, you know, and for a fraction of the cost of what's produced in the United States, which is geared ultimately simply to the profitability of the corporations who dominate the industry.
Well, this whole COVID business, surely it could be just an operation launched by this big pharmaceutical cartel in order to increase its stranglehold on humanity, and particularly through governments mandating vaccines.
Well, it may be the case. I mean, you know my view. I think that this was possibly an engineered virus and deliberately introduced into China to try and break China's economic development. And if that's the case, then what we're really dealing with here is warfare. That's what we're dealing with. And it's the pharmaceutical industry is embedded within the warfare state of the United States. And it's very much a part of the problem.
Okay, what about the role of David Rockefeller? Oh, actually, it was John D. Rockefeller originally, wasn't it? There were two John Rockefellers and then a David, who I met at a Bilderberg conference back in, gosh, was it? Ooh, must be 2003, something like that. These Rockefeller family, where do they figure in all this?
Well, I mean, they are one of the powerful dynasties, aren't they? And, of course, Michael Hudson, the economist, is very forthright about this. I mean, Rockefeller basically made his money through gaming the system and imposing monopolies in the industries in which...
Well, he gained his monopoly in quite an interesting way, I didn't think, in Standard Oil, didn't he? He would set up companies or even secretly buy up companies to secretly spy on his real competitors.
Yes, and of course he then bought up the railroads so that nobody else could move oil around except for him. And of course this is how you actually make money in capitalism, through rent seeking. It's not developing a better product, it's dominating the market. And of course that's how the real free market economy works. There is no free market.
I mean,
rigged.
The Rockefellers made their money in oil, they moved into banking, they now seem to be... many people who are associated with them, at the very least, trying to take over the world of social media, IT and tech and that sort of thing. So we're surely going to end up with just one great big company owning the whole of Britain and America.
Well, I mean, if you actually, you know, there are people who carry out research into this and they've discovered that there are, you know, there's a great deal of linkage of personnel at the top end of the system. It wouldn't be surprising, would it? Elites tend to self-reproduce.
Yeah, they do. Certainly the Rockefellers in the United States, the Rothschilds in Europe, maybe, because, of course, they were a very powerful banking family right across Europe after the end of the 19th century.
I mean, it's not really rocket science, is it, that the wealthy tend to stick together and they tend to have a certain interest.
Yeah, and also there is a sort of logic to all of this, Martin, in that once people have got more money than they could ever spend, then they start to think, well, what can we do with this? They don't need that money to live, to survive, like many, many millions of other people, billions of other people do. They just start to think, well, we can play with this. We can buy up governments. We can buy up whole entire industries, monopolize them. We can buy up press and media. Where does it finish?
Well, it finishes where we are, with a impending global financial crisis and a potential war for the future of the planet.
Is there any way to fight them?
Well, the struggles are going on every day because they have to. People all over the planet are fighting against, you know, bad mega projects, poverty. Going on strike for higher wages.
Well, I mean, you could say there is a successful fight against fracking, wasn't there, at the very least?
Well, that was, you know, that was the last great inflection point, wasn't it? I mean, you know, on a small scale, although it's quite important, there's a vote on union recognition at Amazon. As I mentioned, the Deliveroo stock market listing crashed this week. And it was because basically the courts had decided previously that Delivery were not going to be able to carry on treating all of their 0 hours contract workers as if they were self-employed.
But surely we're never
Delivery, gonna, in fact, hasn't even made a profit even under
but
current But
I mean, the minimum wage isn't necessarily even enough to live on, is it? I mean, the problem here is that we need to have a system by which everybody is guaranteed at least an income. I mean, the thing is, the jobs aren't out there. For all these 10,000 soldiers about to go on the dole or not to be recruited, where are they supposed to go? Where are they supposed to earn a living? Are they supposed to all go on the dole?
Well, I mean, these are fundamental contradictions of capitalism as outlined by, you know, the Marxist pioneers in the 19th century. And nothing really that much has changed. I mean, obviously, there's been a massive.
Well, what about the great? Come on, the great reset is coming over the horizon.
Well, the great reset is the wet dream of the Western ruling class, but the Zoom Davos that they had this year, both Xi Jinping and Putin spoke. I mean, obviously, they don't go every year. And, of course, it was easier for them to just talk on Zoom than to actually go to Switzerland. And they were both basically being kind of guardedly polite to the Western elite. But they were basically saying there ain't going to be a great reset because we're not going to play ball with you.
Oh, dear. Well, what's going to happen instead then?
Well, the Chinese would say the Belt and Road Initiative. They are basically planning, or they were before this crisis hit, to do a Marshall Plan for the developing world, the kind of thing that the US did in Western Europe in the 40s, but on a much bigger scale.
Well, yeah, some will say they're just trying to take over the world.
Well, they would say that this is not the way to think about it. We have got the resources because we've been relatively successful in our own country. We can't invest it all here. We want to help you to do what we've done. And we will, you know, one of the reasons why they've been so successful in the developing world is because when the Chinese oil company comes in and says we want to develop oil industry here, they say we don't expect to make any profit out of this for at least 20 or 30 years. You know, you will take all the profits for the first 30 years and we'll just take something at the end. Yeah, and of course, that completely undercuts the Western multinationals.
It does.
Who make profit straight away.
Anyway, so, I mean, let's just hope the trade war just stays as a trade war. It's nice to see the Suez Canal opening up again and a little boats chugging through. So, you know, we shall see what happens with that trade war. But look, it's the warmongers that I'm more concerned about, because that's one of the things that could come out of this, especially when the Americans realize they've lost the economic battle. That China is actually far, far more efficient than they are at producing stuff and selling it, and that they're very bad losers when they see that they've been completely beaten at their own game, mainly because all they seem to do is just create these various rackets everywhere, as we do in Britain. You know, all those old privatised...
Yeah, that's the problem with having a racket-based system.
The water, etc. It's all rackets, isn't it? The railways is a racket. Everything's a racket over here. But anyway, so I thought one of the listeners very kindly... emailed me in, or sent me in by some means, a reference to a fantastic book which I've been perusing by a guy called Jerry Doherty. It's actually called The Hidden History of World War One, where he talks here about how, you know, the various myths that were put together about how that war started. It clearly was from the very, very top of the ruling class, including the royal families themselves. As we all know, we had Tsar Nicholas and Kaiser Bill and the British king, all cousins, and it was basically just like a family argument between these cousins that created the First World War. But anyway, Jerry goes into some of the finer detail in his book about how it all started. And Martin, we were talking about this a few weeks ago, about the raid by Anthony Blunt on the castle, which is very much like Balmoral. It was basically modelled on Balmoral in Germany, where the German emperor was living and the empress was still alive. He died. And there was a raid right at the end of the Second World War, in the first week after the war, by Anthony Blunt, ordered by the British royal family to go and grab all these letters. And it's not surprising, is it? Because it's quite obvious from what Jerry's dug up here that the royal family was very much involved in actually creating the war rather than fighting it. We had a bizarre situation a few years into World War One, where they had to change their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor to convince the British people that they weren't actually working for the Germans. But anyway, so let's have a listen to Jerry now. And this is an extract from a talk he did with the James Corbett on the Corbett Report about his book, The Hidden History of World War One.
Alfred Lord Milner, as he became, was the man who went out and settled the problem in South Africa by settling the Boers. He actually claimed that it was that creating the war was his doing in order to stop this nonsense in South Africa, safeguard everybody's gold and diamond holdings within the British Empire. And Milner was a great zealot. He called himself a race patriot, did Milner, a great zealot for the British Empire. The man who did most to actually divulge these secrets was an American professor, Carol Quigley. We have great and high regard for Carol Quigley. He was a university professor at Georgetown and in many other places in the States, serious academic. Who was so well in with the British establishment that he was given sight of documents and documentation which have since never been seen again. And through his first book, which I've always found very, very impressive, The Anglo-American Establishment, through that book, he lays the bare traces of what was going on and asks you as a person, asks you, as a historian, somebody wanting to know, he says, follow the clues. Look at what I'm saying. And Jim McGregor and I, in our research, is over 10 years, actually continually went back to Quigley to follow the lines which he indicated. These were, early on, the first members of a group. They're called the group. They called themselves the group. But we gave them, as you so rightly said, we gave them the title, the secret elite. Mapping out, as we have, a notion of a range of people who were either externally or directly part and parcel of a powerful, powerful group of financiers, of politicians, who could effect the kind of change and pursue the kind of international policy which actually led deliberately to World War One. Well, we must remember they had an outcome that they sought. They didn't have stamped the year 1914 on it. In fact, it may well have come earlier if events had turned in different cycles. How did they do this? Well, first of all, in Britain, they had a massive influence politically. It really didn't matter whether the government was called conservative or liberal. It was, in fact, the men who were very much influenced by them, who supported their imperial ideas, who were pushed to the front and who were back to the hilt. So that, in fact, although governments changed, foreign policy never changed. And that's very important. Secondly, in terms of propaganda and journalism, it would be funny if it weren't so tragically sad. And perhaps we can see a repeated, contemporary things happening in the same kind of manner, which ought to make us a bit sceptical and perhaps even fearful. Because stories began to emerge, especially from the early 1900s, that made Germany the new bogeyman. There was in particular a writer of dreadful novels. I can't stress the word dreadful hard enough, but he had a wonderful following, William Le Queux, Q-U-E-U-X. Here's the extent to which Le Queux had influence, or those of influence backed Le Queux. He wrote a ridiculous novel. It pains me to call it a novel, story called 1910. Now, in this story, Germany invades Britain in 1910 and they're marching through the counties of England and they're going to take over the government and all tragedy lies ahead and stupid numbers like 250,000 German spies are already here. What is interesting later is that Northcliffe was the editor of the Daily Mail of the time, the owner of the Daily Mail. And Northcliffe actually spoke to Lecour and said, look, do you think we could change the way that the Germans are invading Britain and go to more major cities? Because each day they said which city the Germans would be in. I mean, it got to ridiculous levels like this. They actually changed the route map in order to sell more papers. But the invidious thing behind it was this message that we have an enemy and they're called Germany and he's called the Kaiser. And the Kaiser was continually bad-mouthed in public, even though... And this is something that this is where history can really annoy. The official stated history does itself great harm. The Kaiser William II, was a great favourite of Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria admired her far more than she admired her son. He was the Emperor of Germany. She died in his arms, in the Kaiser's arms on the Isle of Wight. Queen Victoria died. That's trust for you. That's love for you. But do you think that was published? Do you think that image of the Kaiser is the one which was promulgated? Of course not. He was to be become the bogeyman. He was the man who wanted to have a greater navy than Britain. What impertinence!
So that's Jerry Doherty there. Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the First World War is an extremely complex event, and there's all sorts of perspectives that still, all sorts of different ways of looking at it. The Kaiser, that there certainly was a demonisation of the Germans by the propaganda.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? The Kaiser was when Victoria died. He was with her, holding her hand, and yet, within minutes almost of Victoria dying, there's suddenly a hate campaign against him. But it seems obvious that the purpose of this was to create a war.
Well, you've got fundamental conflicts of interest. The British Empire was an established empire. The Germans, who saw themselves as natural imperialists, didn't have an empire, and they wanted one. And of course, they did have certain colonies in Africa, for example, Tanganyika and Southwest Africa, which, of course, at the end of the First World War, were taken off them and given to Britain. And they in the colonies that the Germans ran, like what is now Namibia, they carried out a policy of extermination of the Herero tribe when they rose up against German rule. And of course, the British haven't got much to boast about on that front, because we virtually tried to exterminate the Kikuyu tribe in Kenya in the 1950s. So what we're dealing with here is rapacious imperial powers. And if you read the history of the 19th century and up to the First World War, there was basically a view amongst the dominant races within which the Japanese, for example, included themselves, and the Germans included themselves, and the British, that they had a right to rule the rest of humanity. And in many ways, we can still see that attitude being displayed today by the United States as a global hegemon. Nobody's allowed to do anything without their say-so.
Okay, so the book is Hidden History, The Hidden History of the First World War by Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor. That interview is with James Corbett, but I've edited out most of James Corbett's voice, and taken about 20 minutes of him. Well, I hate to say waffling, James, but it's just a lot easier to listen to as Jerry talks. We just hear Jerry really without James. And so I'll put that also up on our show page, the full version of that, which is nearly an hour long, but it's a fascinating insight into the origins of the First World War. And it goes into, in fact, maybe Martin, you might want to say something about the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which has now transpired was no accident at all.
Well, it wasn't an accident, because it was a deliberate assassination, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't. All I'm saying is that the idea that it triggered the war wasn't an accident.
Well, the war was going to happen one way or another because of the antagonisms that we've just been elucidating. And we're in a not dissimilar position today where, great powers, human affairs are generally dominated by war. Peace is the exception. And, you know, but the danger is that as we move into a more multipolar world order with the Americans having less power than they used to have, is that they're not going to accept that willingly and are prepared to fight to try and retain what they've got.
Well, I mean, I've been cheerleading the Murdoch press, unfortunately. I don't like doing it, but, you know, these are the guys that are doing the stuff on talk radio and at the Next Revolution with Steve Hilton. So we have a look now. I mean, another one is the Daily Mail. He's talking there about the Daily Mail being pro-fascist. But the Mail this week, Martin, has come out with a couple of articles. I'm not sure if you've seen them both. One on 9/11, another on MH370. Maybe we can start with MH370. What they're saying there is that the Americans done it. That's the article.
Well, I think that's interesting. And as you know, Tony, despite the fact that the media is dominated by vested interests, there are always shafts of light and, you know, occasional jewels, even in places like the Daily Mail, where you wouldn't expect to find them. And often, of course, what happens is that people who allow these articles to be printed are not really aware of the implications of what they're doing, and therefore they allow them through. But, you know, all information needs to be critically evaluated.
Anyway, so they're saying that in the MH370 article, this is the aircraft that disappeared on its way from Kuala Lumpur up to Beijing a few years ago. The Malaysian aircraft, of course, another Malaysian aircraft it was that got shut down. The Malaysian government, by the way, has an arrest warrant out for Bush and Blair, and also Zippy Livni, who was the former defense secretary of the Israelis, because they've been tried in absentia in Malaysia for war crimes and found guilty. So, you know, this is another reason that the Malaysians might like, you know, there may be an attempt to get the Malaysians rather than other people. But MH370, Martin, what they're saying in this is that the US used electronic means, warfare means, to communicate with and take over control of the aircraft.
Well, that's pretty clear that they've got that technology, because that's what they were using on 9/11, Global Hawk technology. And, you know,
the ability to steer an airliner from, say, an AWACS aircraft. That's what they're suggesting. Yeah. And the reason was that because they didn't want the Chinese to get hold of some technology which was on the plane, apparently.
Well, that's perfectly plausible explanation of the event, isn't it? I mean, I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's certainly...
Anyway, I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Of course, there's anyone that's been following MH370, there was a whole load of personnel from something called Fremantle Electronics on there who were making that sort of trip. And in fact, there was a large contingent of that company. They were doing electronic warfare in the United States. They had been pitching their ideas to the Pentagon and got nowhere, because of course that's a cartel over there, and they were thinking, well, let's take some of these ideas over to China, and then of course the plane disappeared. But anyway, it's the 9/11 one we're going to talk about now, and I think before we hear from Webster Tarpley, let's just look at the article in today's Daily Mail, I think. Yes, it's today's Mail, Friday's conspiracy theory that still won't rest in peace. Think it's only cranks who believe the Twin Towers attack was a US government plot? 20 years on, the family of one British victim is demanding a fresh inquest in the hopes of proving just that. This is Jeff Campbell's last terrified moments, trapped in the 106th floor of the North Tower of New York's World Trade Center. He's 31 years old. He made his mark as a brilliant risk analyst. But his brother wants the inquest into his death reopened, Martin.
Yes, well, I have met Matt, and obviously it's because of his efforts that the Daily Mail have run the story. And, of course, it was the Daily Mail in a features section which serialised Ian Henshaw's book about 9/11. So, you know,
what they've chosen is the belief as a family that controlled demolition was involved in the towers falling down, and the aircraft and fires, which were nearly out at the top of the buildings, can't have been responsible.
Well, we've already got the University of Fairbanks, Alaska, putting together a peer-reviewed paper which shows that the buildings could not have collapsed as a result of fires caused by aeroplane fuel. And it's pretty obvious if you look at the Building 7, it goes down in free fall speed, which could only happen if the buildings were bombed. And if the buildings were bombed, then it wasn't carried out by people with bolt cutters who'd infiltrated from Afghanistan, was it?
No, it seems like it was a made-for-TV production. But anyway, one of the people that did the best book, which was called Synthetic Terror, Made in USA, 9/11, was Webster Tarpley. And I was very annoyed this week with Google for removing that from my YouTube channel, one of them anyway, for so-called hate speech. Well, as far as I'm concerned, there's absolutely no hate speech in there. This is just a pathetic and very undignified and despicable excuse to be using to get rid of a excellent expose of the criminals who are really behind the September the 11th attacks. Well, I think we can look at both aspects of the US and Israeli governments involved in that, possibly the Brits too. Martin, what do you think?
I think that's quite likely the case, that they were all involved in it in one way or another. And, of course, we're going to have an awful lot of propaganda about 9/11 in the run-up to the anniversary in September. And I think it's very important that people do take another look at the evidence, which has massed over the last 20 years, that this is clearly an act of war carried out in the United States, on the United States, by the United States deep state. And, of course, the thing is that you can be sure that both the Russian and Chinese general staffs are very well aware that that is what happened, and they are making their plans accordingly.
Well, they certainly are. And what about, I mean, the Israelis have obviously benefited massively from this in terms of getting a whole load of American troops down there to do their fighting for them.
Well, that's right, and they're pushing, as we speak, for a war on Iran, as they always have been. And I feel like turning round to Priti Patel and saying, right, so it's a war on Iran. The Israelis want a war on Iran. Priti, do you want us to join in that war? Because if you do, the answer to that is definitely going to be no.
Well, there's that.
Most
that
ordinary
one.
People in this country have no interest in that whatsoever.
Well, good comparison to make. We know the WikiSpooks article, 9/11, Israel did it all, the truth in the world, is the one he put a link into it that the Reverend Stephen Sizer was told by his bishop. He was a reverend in Virginia Water in southwest London, vicar. And he was told by his bishop never to mention the Middle East in any of his sermons, which is one of the most farcical things to say to a serving vicar that you can ever imagine, after he shared this article. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page, of course, at thisweek.org.uk. 9/11, Israel did it all, the proof in the world. Well, you know, I'm not saying they did, but it's an interesting article, nevertheless, which is pinning a lot of the...
I think it's perfectly legitimate to point the finger at the Israelis, not least because of the five dancing Israelis, which Mossad agents filming the first strike by an aircraft on the first tower. And I don't think they did it on their own. The deep state in the US and Israel is very deeply intertwined, as are our own military and intelligence.
Yeah, I think whenever we see one of these big spectacular events, which we're all supposed to believe has been done by A, B or C, it's really important to listen to what Webster Tarpley had to say, which good old Google and YouTube took down this week. But this is one of the key little extracts from it. It's only a couple of minutes. But here he explains about things like the patsies involved. So people who get blamed, they're involved right from the start, and there are also moles within the intelligence services and within the military, within air traffic control, things like that, who are agents who are working for outside companies, outside governments, etc., as well as the technicians, who are the people who are actually fixing the bombs, this sort of thing, and making sure that things go bang and whiz at the right time in order to, you know, create the right effect in front of all of our TV cameras. Of course, this is one of the main aspects, Martin, of the September the 11th attacks, is the way that we had two towers, didn't we? So the first one, a plane crashes into it, all the cameras are fixed on that, ready for the second one.
Yeah, it's a scripted event. It's a military operation, And it's a military operation that wasn't carried out by a few scruffy Arabs from Afghanistan. It's clearly, I mean, if there were bombs in the buildings and the University of Fairbanks, Alaska, with its peer-reviewed paper, has showed that it must have been bombs in the buildings, then they must have been planted by somebody. And the only people with access to those buildings to plant those bombs would be people within the US military intelligence apparatus. So they're the guilty parties.
I know you had a little.
There's nothing much more to say, is there?
Well, there is one little thing, and that's a little anecdote from you, which is your encounter with an American diplomat of some sort. Was it the day after the September?
No, it was just some weeks after.
Oh, was it?
I went to a seminar at the LSE about the future of American power, and I confronted Mort Dworkin III there, who was political attaché at the US Embassy. And I went up to him outside the venue, and I said, and I had a little leaflet that I was handing out to everybody in the seminar, and I said, you do realise that the deputy director of the FBI has resigned last July because he said Bush was protecting bin Laden. And he said, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. And I said, well, we know too. And, of course, there's lots of evidence, all sorts of different kinds of evidence, which lead back to the obvious conclusion that this was a power play by the deep state in the US to create the conditions to recolonize the developing world and to put China and Russia in their box. And to do that, they need to bamboozle their own population, which is exactly what was, and terrify them and terrorize them.
Yeah, there's a few echoes of the COVID stuff there. But anyway, let's have a listen to Webster Tarpley speaking in New York City on the 15th of January 2005. He was pretty good at getting up to speed with what had been going on. And this is a little extract from the Key to Stopping World War III talk.
My method essentially regards terrorist events as composites. They're a point of intersection of three or four different levels of reality. And the main thing you have to understand is you've got certainly the people you see, right? The ones we've just showed you, Atta and company. Those are the dupes, the useful idiots, the fanatics, but above all, the double agents who run them. Those are the scapegoats who are going to take the fall. The problem you always have to apply is, does the patsy have the physical technical ability to create the effects observed? Can Lee Harvey Oswald, using the Mannlicher Carcano 1917 rifle, successfully fire the requisite number of shots with bolt action in the time that he has? No. And it doesn't depend on his criminal intent. He can have all the criminal intent in the world. It won't let him do it. And these guys, you can say, oh, they hate us. Oh, they hate us. Doesn't matter how much they hate you. They can't do it. Okay, so this is a whole world of provocateurs, double agents. This is sort of the wormy underside of FBI, CIA, NSA, the rest of them. You've also got to look for moles, government officials loyal to a private network. This is important. They don't follow the chain of command, even. They're not, certainly not loyal to a constitution, but they're rather loyal to a clique. It's ultimately in Wall Street, but it's also senior government officials, generals, and people like this. Those are the moles. They also have to organize the cover-up. The moles have to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies before the fact. Not because the patsies are going to carry out the attack, but because if the patsies are already in jail, you can't blame the crime on the patsies. So they've got to stay free, and then they've got to be arrested immediately, and you've then got to have a cover-up. And then you have professional killers. There's got to be a role in this for, I believe, a privatized command center. There's got to be a role for assassins, in other words, people like the people who really killed Kennedy, coming into town, getting out of town. Patsies love attention. They love to get on TV. Again, Oswald gets on TV, gets on the radio, gets noticed. Atta, same thing, right? Always fighting with people, abrasive. Then the professional killers, who don't say anything, they come in, shoot, leave. They're not ideologues in the same sense. They're not interested in popping off in public. Before we leave, just a privatized command center, again, outside, I believe, not certainly not Dick Cheney. Can you imagine you're going to have this whole operation, you're going to make it depend on a guy who's 4 heart attacks and 3 pacemakers, sitting there with his wife who keeps turning the CNN up so he can't hear the interagency task force talking? And the whole thing doesn't work without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Okay? And that's state-sponsored false flag terrorism, because the thing says we're Al-Qaeda, and they're not Al-Qaeda. They're a branch of CIA and MI6.
And the Mossad, someone says at the end in the background there, Martin.
Fairly accurate. And, you know, one has to hope that as we come up to this 20th anniversary, there are it's an opportunity for those of us who've been pointing these things out for years to go back and point them all out again, because the purpose of the atrocity was to create exactly the conditions that we see, the possibility of imperialist war. And of course, it wasn't just 9/11. The CIA, MI6 and Western intelligence services have been involved in false flag terrorism going all the way back to World War II and the creation of the Gladio stay behind networks in Europe. 9/11 is just the most spectacular fulfillment of that kind of program. But the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which killed nearly 90 people, was a similar operation. And of course, for everybody, every individual that dies is an individual. And of course, whether it's 3,087 or a million people dying in Iraq. But of course, it's all. Well,
it's fascinating, isn't it, Martin? I mean, I think we need to make this little connection here, which is, you know, you talking about Operation Gladio going on, you know, the NATO intelligence services blowing up people in Europe in order to try and blame it on Russia. And there we've got the intelligence services blowing up New York and Washington to try and blame it on some guy in a cave in Afghanistan. The origin of this actually is these Nazi units, isn't it, that were around at the end of the Second World War. The so-called werewolf units, and this is something that was basically incorporated into NATO after the war.
Yes. So, in other words, the kind of things that the fascists used to do, like the burning of the Reichstag, and the creation of all sorts of, you know, before they invaded Poland, they staged a fake operation whereby the Poles had apparently crossed the border at Gliwice and started killing Germans. It's basically pretty transparently made up story. But of course, the sophistication of what goes on now is far in advance of what happened.
Well, I mean, that Gliwice incident, they used it lethal injections. And it's amazingly, I don't know if any records was kept of the person, but one or two people actually survived their lethal injections. They were left as bodies to be photographed. To give an excuse to invade Poland in the newspapers. And by the way, the United States, I'm not sure about the British press, but the US press definitely printed all those stories as truth. Oh, the Polish have come into Germany, so what are the Germans going to do now? You know, there was a definite attempt by the press to make, you know, not really to check their facts on that story at all. And those some of those dead bodies, supposed dead bodies, actually came back to life after the incident, amazingly. So they'd be certainly interesting people to interview. But Martin, look, the main problem now is the sorts of people involved in this kind of operation today are mainly, obviously, there are people within the official services, but go along the lines of your Mr. Prinz. You sent a letter to me, an email to me this week about, and there's a terrific article about him. It's in The Spectator, and if that's .us, so maybe it's an American version of The Spectator, is it?
I think it is, yeah.
Anyway, the headline is just called The Dark Prince, a short history of a very modern mercenary. And this is effectively what's going on now, isn't it? You've got these private military companies, really like little private armies, that will do anything that the main army, you know, a national army, the Ministry of Defence or whatever, doesn't dare to do.
Yeah, and there's an interaction between the two, the official level and the unofficial level. And so, you know, you had your Police and Crime Commissioner chap on there earlier saying that it when he was in Northern Ireland, he never saw any evidence of collaboration between the loyalists and the loyalist paramilitaries in the army. Well, these things tend to be done in silos. The Force Research Unit, which was working behind the scenes, which was run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was he was actually a colonel at the time, they don't tell everybody who's in the British Army in Northern Ireland what they're doing. They don't tell anybody what they're doing. They just get on with it. And the same is true of all of these kind of operations.
Yeah, so people like Eric Prince, I mean, this is really signing a death warrant for our children into the future.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happened is there's been an increasing... The CIA, for example, is no longer just a public institution. It's actually been broken up into lots of subcontractors. Yeah, so there's lots and lots of, you know, people like James Le Mesurier, who was the godfather of the White Helmets. He's not directly employed by the British government, but he contracts to them and so on. And, of course, this allows all sorts of cutouts to take place where you can say, well, that's nothing to do with us, even though you're actually pulling the strings.
Yeah, I suppose that's the danger of it, isn't it, having these private armies, which is why they've always been so... Anyway, it's a terrific article. Thank you for it. I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. No modern US war, it says, would be complete without the involvement of Blackwater founder Eric Prince, says Jeremy Scarhill, the journalist, in his seminal book Dirty Wars back in 2013. Since its founding in 97, Blackwater, the private military outfit of Prince, has been reincarnated several times under different names, but he has stayed the same. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Prince, a very 21st century mercenary, has wreaked havoc in all these places. He comes, he spoils, and he leaves a mess that's impossible to clear up.
Well, it was Blackwater operatives that shot down 17 civilians in the main square in Baghdad, didn't they? And they were serving time in US prison, and Trump, as one of his last actions, let them out. And, you know, they basically are gangsters. There's no other word for it, really. And, you know, he is a very big fish in that world.
Yeah, I notice also is it Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu? Yeah, that's right. There was an operation by Blackwater there, and it was uncovered by guess who? Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab did a press conference saying Blackwater are in this country and they are blowing things up and trying to blame it on us. Yeah, of course, that was the press spokesperson for Al-Shabaab, and within months he had been killed by a drone attack. So, you know, these people are there to make sure that there's no coincidence as to whether or not a so-called domestic movement against the government is going to succeed or not. They make sure it turns into a bloodbath.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about him is that he's obviously very integrated into the Western Intelligence Service structure, but he's also a bit of a maverick. And of course, that can be a dangerous thing to be.
Yeah, who's he working for, I suppose, is the question.
Well, I mean, one of the things in the article says, the problem with using mercenaries is they then get their own interests. You know, if you read your Machiavelli, you'll see, you know, mercenaries may decide to do a deal with the people that you've, you know, you pay for them to go and do a job for you.
Well, like,
they might decide to go to the people that you've said you want to target and say, if you give us more money, then we might not do it.
Well, like a crooked detective at Avon and Somerset Constabulary, for example, they might be taking money from the public and also from Lloyd's Bank. But anyway, Martin, we'll say goodbye to you now, because we're just going to finish with a 10-minute clip from Alan Watt about the Great Reset. Happy Easter. And have a good one, and we'll be with you again next week.
Okay, bye then, folks.
Anyway, so thanks, Martin. Well, so we're going to hear now, finally, from Alan Watt, who died a few weeks ago. One of his last broadcasts, I think it could be his last broadcast, which was he was getting very, very deeply into the pandemic and doing long polemics against it, really, I suppose you'd say, so explaining things. And here he is talking about the Great Reset and experimental vaccine and informed consent, but he's focusing particularly here on the depopulation agenda.
you're living through incredible times, witnessing it all. Most folk are unaware of what they're witnessing because they've been stampeded through terror, a war of terror upon them by the authorities. Because the best way to get rapid change and compliance is when you're terrified of dying. And that's why Klaus Schwab said it too, is that this is a war we're using, you know, a war, you know. You could never do it in a peaceful way. We just ignored them, you see. The climate change scenario wasn't working out. Now they're talking about global cooling again. So this is better, you see. They can really rush it through under the war. And no one's going to come out of this without being non-essential, except the very big boys, you know, and gals. And you'll all be non-essential, and you'll accept that you're useless eaters. You understand what's happening here? Do you really understand what's happening? Never in history have nations been shut down entirely by an order from their own governments, business-wise, into complete bankruptcy scenarios. Never happened. Never in history have the healthy been quarantined. This is the first. This is a worse. And this is the best thing they could think of to shut the whole planet down. And to destroy all the systems that were, and nations, by the way, that were. And what emerges out of it is a new planned society. Oh, they'll give you the appearance of nations to an extent, but you're already international anyway, you see. And all the world organizations that are, even the extra ones that pushed through under COVID, to make sure we're all coordinated and for our greater good, you understand. On finances and so on and so on. Oh, these global societies, well, technically, you see, that when they all merge together, you've got a global order, you know. That's it. There you are. They're calling it a new world order. There's that term again, because they're always giving us new world orders, you see. Always. The Soviet system was to be a new world order, you know, a utopia for workers. And they called it new world order. Hitler's was going to be the same. They're both socialist societies. Communism and Nazism. And the leader loves socialism, whether you call it communism. So remember, Stalin just said that communism is socialism in a hurry. We'll get hung up in terms, but it's what you see. If it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, you know. Don't get hung up on words, because they can change words, and that confuses folk till he throws them right off. You're looking at the same thing, but you'll never really apply it to what it was applied to before. Oh, yeah, I recognize that. It reminds me, too, of Theo Adorno. You know, Theo Adorno was amazing. And he worked with Horkheimer and a whole bunch of other people in the Frankfurt School. But he talks about eradicating completely Western values and culture, how it'd have to be done for a healthy world. Completely. How do you destroy healthy values? What do you introduce to replace those values? Well, unhealthy ones. And you watch society getting wrecked. Yeah? What makes a society complete? It's not a matter of do you like it or not. What makes it function and strong? Then the family unit, where families had to take care of their own. You do away with that by encouraging promiscuity and non-marriage. So the state ends up taxing more people to pay for the unwanted. And then you bring in abortion clinics and you pay for that too. And then you don't have folk getting married at all and reproducing. And then you introduce new kinds of families and so on. This is war scenarios, you see. That's what you use for war. But you must get the folk to like what you're doing. And it's quite easy to get youngsters to like whatever they're, especially when it's the candy at the checkout counter. You know? I used to give the talks on all that, how the psychology was used, because it's admitted, and you've probably come to the conclusion without any be told, but why are all the candies you see in a store, even general stores and grocery stores, all the candies are at the checkout counter? And all, generally from shoulder level downwards, you know, from different levels, as so the children can grab them with a restriction. There's nothing separating the child from the candy, and their arms just go out, boom, and oh, I want that. And mum or dad says, well, you can't have that right now. And then the child puts on a screaming match, and no one, and it's all psychology, you know. If you've ever studied the people who do the Bernays techniques, that's where a lot of behaviorism came from, is all these techniques that have been practiced before even Bernays came along. He inherited a lot of the knowledge, but how do you make people buy? Well, people, psychology, if you're in a line at a checkout counter, you feel embarrassed if there's a queue behind you and you're holding it up. You feel guilty. Guilt is an incredible persuader. That's why they use it now against COVID, you see. Guilt. And actually, they have it in their manuals and the PSYOP operations right now. But and I really mean that. I've got them here. Use guilt as a weapon to make folk to comply, you see. Well, they got it from that kind of checkout counter idea, where mum or dad feels embarrassed and she's got her groceries all sitting there, and here's the people behind them going, here's a screaming child, and she'll pay it, you see, and okay. And so naturally, the child's going to do it every time it's there. Eh? It worked, right? And that's why it's there. Well, if you want to destroy society and culture, and like they said in the Communist Manifesto, the end of the family unit, and so it said the same thing too by Albert Pike at one point. If he's talking about end, because he belonged to the World Revolutionary Party, and he talked about ending not just the family unit, but private property for most people. I say most; it's very important that little word, the most thing. And but then you again, the end. How do you destroy the family? Well, you create promiscuity. How do you also do what Julian Huxley said? We'd have to knock humans off their pedestal as being a superior creature on the planet and bring them down to the level of animals. Well, you've got to take away the sacredness of human life. You understand that? So you start getting rid of your own human life before it's born. Yeah? And then folk accept that part. Now you end up in the elderly. Now we've got euthanasia for them. Now, right? And what's next? Well, guess what? What's your... Oh, I see you're non-essential here. How old are you? It doesn't matter about your age anymore. You're just non-essential. Back to Bertrand Russell, useless eater, right? So the checkout counter for teenagers, quite easy to do. How do you create mass promiscuity? Knowing they'll never bond with a person for long is almost impossible, you know, after a time. And then you promote it as normal culture. When it becomes normal, you know, everybody's doing it. Then that's what they said to do, and H.G. Wells talked about it too, you know, different techniques to get folk to practice promiscuity to end marriage. He belonged in the late 1800s, H.G. Wells. That's where they picked him up initially and used him as a front man. And for free love, you know, he's writing about free love in the late 1800s. Well, as a consequence to free love, there was no welfare system there, folks. And so on, yeah. So, again, you've got, you know, create promiscuity. Here's the, what is it? Every teenager has got their hormones jumping. Nature wants it to have its way, you know. And so, like the child in the, you know, here's the checkout counter and he's all the candy. You tell them to go ahead and do it all. Through media, mainly through television at the time, and 1960s, leading up to it in the 1950s, but 1960s, and where you go. Give them the pop music, tell them it's their generation and no one can hold them back. Give them the music.
Yep, give them the music. And in fact, he then goes on to talk about Plato, going on about the, talking about the, anyway, I'll put the full interview with Alan Watt there up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it's nearly 2 hours of one of his very last ever broadcasts. And, you know, it's just such a tragedy that he's no longer with us, dying at age 55 suddenly. And there obviously got to be questions at that inquest. Let's see what happened to Alan. Who knows? But anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also in the first hour, Tom Baldwin from Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, who's standing for Mayor of Bristol. We won't get any replies to our request for interviews from Marvin Rees, the Labour Blairite Mayor, who's incumbent, or Sandy Hall Ruthven, his fellow Common Purpose graduate, who's standing for the Green Party, having taken masses of public money privatising the youth services at Bristol City Council. Obviously all chummy with the city elite. But anyway, also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Since Yahoo and Google have maneuvered me onto their email lists and then banned those lists, either for posts I couldn't moderate or for fake anti-Semitism claims, yeah, not them again, the only way to be included on my weekly email circulation list is to email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. So that's tony@cultureshop, S-H-O-P, not T, .org.uk. And you'll find that address, because it's obviously difficult to remember these damn email addresses, at the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. So if you've only caught a little bit or you haven't got time to listen to it all, you can always come back and listen again there. And over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make recordings yourself, as we've been beset with gremlins. Feel free to upload, download and rebroadcast this show. Actually, funnily enough, the gremlins have not been there so much since we left BCFM, and their rather unreliable program archiving system, which sometimes just didn't work at all. But anyway, please, if you're going to broadcast elsewhere, do so and credit us, and we'll list you here as well. Let us know. And you can hear a lot more of my longer interviews. These are the ones, for example, this week, the longer interview with Alan Watt and the long one with Mike Yeadon on this stream throughout the rest of the week. My three ebooks, not censored. We were looking quite again at the censorship of Webster Tarpley and his explanation of the criminals behind the September the 11th attacks. My three ebooks published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown. That's The Traitors of Arnhem, which is about the origins of the Bilderberg conferences and the secret Nazi-chaired meeting for the first 20 years. It was picking all of our leaders across Europe and the United States. There's also another book called The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader. The Siege of Heaven is a collection of my articles, and The Siege of Heaven Reader is, and I'll be sending that out with this week's email, probably Sunday. And that is a collection of articles about hidden power, secret power and secret societies ever since the end of the medieval period. And those will be sent out with emails over the next few weeks. But that one particularly, The Siege of Heaven Reader, is definitely going to go out on Sunday. A small version of it. You can actually buy a copy via Bilderberg.org, a proper copy of the ebook at Bilderberg.org, or via our Martin Bormann tab of our show site at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or a story you'd like to share, if you think there's anything I've missed or have a correction, please do reply to the weekly email, or just email me via the website. The email address, as I say, is there. And see if you can include a link or two, or even a phone number and a scan of what you have, if possible. And you never know, it might pop up on the show in the next few weeks, as we did a really good interview, I think, with Joey Doherty tonight. Thank you very much for the listener that prompted that one. And you can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll not find the BCFM, find the BCFM politics shows, podcast, story links, comment page, and all our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can find me at tlio.org.uk, 911forum.org.uk, and of course at bilderberg.org, as well as the show page. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable Easter weekend as things begin to open up. Do please join us for the politics show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, inshallah. God bless. Have a lovely time casting off the COVID shadow this Easter, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
Oh, sometimes it causes
There, when they took him from the cross, were you there when they took him from the cross? Stone was rolled away. Were you there when the stone was rolled away?